This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We're the sidewalk ends and the road begins. We said goodbye on cold.
My next guest is from the great state of Texas, or at least he lives there. They like country music. I'm not sure if he does or not, but joining me is Colby Volkey. And, you know, Colby, when I say your name, I want to say Volkey, not Volkey.
No, there's no L in that, not at all.
I know, but I'm going to fight it. Just so you know, I probably won't say your last name after this. But maybe one more time. But just so you know, for whatever reason, my mouth wants to say Colby Volkey. Have you ever thought of changing your name to Volkey?
Not at all. the Volk thing would be a German thing, and my name is not German.
Whoa.
It's a Viking.
Well, oh. Are you a George Strait fan?
I am. He's a George Strait fan.
He supposedly is a great guy. So,
I can imagine he's a good guy. He's got a lot of things that could make him a good guy, that's for sure.
Yeah, he's done okay in life. I wanted to have you on and talk a couple of different topics. One, I don't think that we have learned all the lessons that I think Haditha has to offer to military professionals. That's just me, because I've kind of looked about it, and I got interested in Haditha after I got interested in MeLive. And this whole concept of post-combat related mental health, the concept of keep your honor clean, how keeping your honor clean feeds into your mental health, and how we could do, in the Marine Corps especially, how we could do a better job on that continuum. And so had Neil Puckett, who you know, on a couple times, have seen the documentary House 2, had Adam Linehan on, who wrote a piece, a pretty extensive piece about the documentary. And so I reached out to Colby months ago, and no response. And I thought, damn, he's been on my program before. I know I didn't do anything to him. No response. So what, a few weeks ago, I get this message on LinkedIn, Mac, hey, I didn't see this, man. And I'm like, oh. I was relieved, honestly. I was like, wow, well, at least he's not hating on me. So Colby joins the program, and so we're going to introduce him now so that you guys can determine whether you should believe him or not. So Colby, born and raised where?
Is that born and raised a lawyer?
Yeah, where were you born and raised?
Oh, born and raised. Oh, I was born in Dallas, Texas, raised here. Went to Texas A&M.
Whoa. Were you one of those guys? Were you marched out?
I was. Absolutely. It was actually there. I went there thinking I might go in the Navy. And when I got there, seeing the Marines that ran the program there at Texas A&M, that's what made me switch and become a Marine.
Well, then, you know what? We can forgive you for the whole boots thing, because you were confused. You were a young guy. You were confused. You're wearing the boots. You want to be in the Navy. Then now I get it. All right, so that's explainable. The boots. Do you still have your boots? What do you do? Are they framed? What do you do with those things?
No, I did, but I actually passed them down to my son. My son ended up going to Texas A&M in the Corps of Cadets, and he wore the same boots. So that's what I did with them. They got used twice.
So you had
now
your,
my son.
Your son is Kent Dorfman? He's a legacy.
Yep. Wow. Absolutely. So my son is now, he just finished infantry officer school a few months ago. He's now stationed with 2-7 out there in 29 Palms.
Where men are men. Yes. That's awesome. Well, congratulations. No, I have one that was in 1-7 who's at the basic school, probably at the basic school when your kid went through, and then another one in 3-5. So, no, it's pretty proud. I mean, you can't direct that, certainly. But I will tell you this, as a father of two, infantry officers. Pretty proud, button popping proud that they chose that. And I like it. I like them. I think I wouldn't say this to their face. I like them a little bit more because they chose the things that I'm passionate about in my life. So I don't know. You're a lawyer, a little bit higher form of life than an infantryman. Proud that
yeah, but I started artillery. So
well, again, misguided, but it's okay. Misguided. Almost okay. So, so the Marine Corps, you don't have any contact with the Marine Corps. Well, let's talk about your decision just to go to Texas A&M and look at the Navy. Where did that come from? How does the military get in, get on your radar as a young guy?
Well, my dad had this interest in the military. He was actually from Newfoundland. And he himself joined the Air Force, which was kind of a, if you'd asked him back in the day, he would have said that. He didn't know why he did that. But he grew up on the sea and, you know, they were in a little fishing village in Newfoundland. So he always was encouraging us to go into the Navy. And, but when I went to Texas A&M, Corps of Cadets, I was surrounded by some Marines that were working at the NRTC, one in particular, a guy named Major Bob Fawcett.
Oh yeah, and, he was my. You know what? I just saw him earlier this month at the change of command at the 2nd Marine Division.
I just saw him last month. As a matter of fact, for the first time in many years, we had a kind of a Marine reunion, mostly a bunch of Aggies, and we invited him out in Virginia. And so I got to see him for the first time in a long, long time. So he is the one who inspired me to become a Marine.
Bob Fawcett. He was the CEO of the basic school when I was an instructor there.
Right.
Good dude. Good dude.
Yeah,
it was great seeing him here recently. All right, so you know what? And I will tell you this. I mean, the Marine Corps puts some pretty worse squared away folks into its MOI programs, knowing that it's those guys are going to attract those guys, men and male and female, are going to attract talented young people at universities. And I, you know, it's really interesting how Marines impress, you know, young people. Jeremiah Workman, who's a recipient of the Navy Cross in 3-5 in Fallujah, he talked about sitting in his cafeteria. His dad had had a conversation about, hey, look, if you're going to college, you're paying yourself, but at 18, you're on your own, son. And so he said, sitting there, and he thought about the military a little bit, and in walks this, you know, recruiter, big shoulders, small waist, good-looking uniform, looks up from lunch and said, who's that? And, you know, from the get-go, Marines have this tendency to optically impress, and you walk up and meet them. They try to rip your hand off, and it goes from there. And it's just and it's been that way for a long, long time. So your experience no different. So talk to me. So you initially commissioned when, and you become an artilleryman?
Yeah, commissioned in 1987. Went to basic school a few months later, and I thought I was going to be an infantry officer going all the way through. And then about a month before the MOS selection, they had us out calling for fire. And I, you know, even when you're a naive second lieutenant, you don't know any better. I thought that was the greatest thing they've ever done in my life. And I couldn't believe they're going to pay me money to do it. It never occurred to me that other people can call for fire other than artillery officers. And the fact that most artillery officers are at the other end of the guns. But that's why I made that decision. And, but I, no regrets. I loved artillery. Got to go, I was an XO during Desert Storm.
Ooh.
And got to do a lot of firing, and it was high tempo. It was pretty satisfying. I will tell you that.
I mean, did you have you read the stories that I can't remember who is just the firing battery over in Syria that they destroyed the barrels in their guns? They fired so many rounds over there. Did you read that? Did you see any of that?
I didn't. I've heard of that. I didn't read that. But we fired quite a bit. Our battery was, we were just pumping rounds out. We were in general support. And we had a fire direction officer, a guy named Pete Hilgartner, who was one of the best artillerymen I've ever seen. who was so good that he would, any fire mission to any of the batteries, he would always have it, figure out the solution, have the data to the guns, and that way if any battery was too slow in getting the mission out, he would call up to the battalion and say, "Wait, we've got it, the data on the guns, with do not load ready to go," and it would cancel some of the battery's mission and we would fire. So we were firing just nonstop. It was good.
Give me one lesson learned from your experience in combat as an executive officer. What battery?
I was with Lima Battery, 4th Battalion, 12th Marines, and we were part of 2nd Battalion, 12th Marines, attached to 10th Marine Regiment.
Okay.
I think one lesson learned is you can't let your guard down even when the fighting stops, because that's when a lot of accidents can happen. So, when the war ended, everybody started kind of slacking off, getting a little sloppy, and I saw a Marine get hurt and killed, I think unnecessarily, after the fact. And so just like when you go do an exercise and, the index, and that's when you see, car crashes or any kind of problems that happen like that. It was no different in combat. When all of a sudden the fighting stopped, people let off and got sloppy. And you cannot do that because Marine safety is too important.
When you hear that admonition, hey, now's one of the most dangerous times of the exercise because everybody wants to get home and people are going to cut corners. And everybody kind of rolls their eyes when they hear that. But it's advice steeped in experience, sadly. And,
absolutely.
And it's true. It's true. I remember, I want to say the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment had a huge fire in their vehicle park, and they lost, I want to say, 50 Bradleys or something crazy like that because of, they had them all stacked in a very small area. A fire started. They couldn't get them out of the area and they couldn't control the fire. And it was all based on sloppiness and lack of following their own procedures. So no, interesting point well made. So how does the law thing? Where does that come from?
I think I was inspired when I was stationed in Okinawa, still in artillery, and sat as a member of a court martial. And I saw. I sat as a member twice, but the one stuck in my head was, it was a bad check case of some young Marine, being tried for writing bad checks, and, prosecutor walked in, he was a major, knew what he was doing, had his act together, defense counsel was a first lieutenant, obviously knew, seemed to be kind of clueless, and I was watching him, and that Marine deserved, proper legal defense, and it didn't look like he was getting it, and I kind of thought to myself, I can learn what's in those books on his table and I could do the job better than he could. So that's what made me start thinking, I think I want to go do that and, try cases in the Marine Corps. And, I also something that impacted me was, going in for deliberation. And, we had a major who was a senior member on the panel and we walked in for deliberation. One of the first things he said to me was, "All right, let's convict this guy so we can get out of here." And, I said, "Well, sir, I think, we're supposed to, talk about the evidence." And he jumped my case. "What, do you think this guy's not guilty? You tell me why you think he's not guilty." I said, "Oh, sir, I didn't say that. I just said, I think we're supposed to talk about the evidence." So, it was kind of a shocking little revelation. And they always say that, rank doesn't matter in the deliberation room, but of course it does. And, in that case, we ended up talking through it and we found him guilty of some and not guilty of others. So I think the process ultimately worked, but I'm not sure if had I not said anything, if he would have just tried to pressure us all to find him guilty of everything. So I think those two things in that one case, really sparked my interest and I thought, there's something to be done here. So, I left Okinawa and I was on I&I duty and I put in the package for the law program and got selected.
Interesting. Did you have any legal background in your family or anything, or it all stemmed from your involvement in these two cases, court martial?
Very, very little. My mom was an advocate for the Dallas Tenants Association. She was not a lawyer or a paralegal or anything. She was an advocate for the Dallas Tenants Association, where she would advocate on behalf of kind of low-income tenants and against slumlords. So that's about, I would hear about from there, but that was, that's about as close to a legal background at all. It was really watching this happen in the courtroom. And also serving as a legal officer for a battalion. So
interesting, interesting. So where do you go? Where do you go to law school?
I went to, and you're going to know this one. I went to the University of North Dakota, right there in Grand Forks.
You know what? That's our, that was our the basis for our initial discussion. Now, did you get selected and go funded law, or did you do this on your own?
No, I did the excess leave program, which, you know, the Marine Corps, I think, is the only service that does it because, well, we're kind of cheap sometimes. But
sometimes.
So you have to you have to pay your own way, and you don't get paid while you're going to class either. So you basically end up with about Lance Corporal pay, and you're paying for your own law school. So I have to take out loans and everything else. The only advantage is that you are still on active duty. So you know, time and service and all that as you're going through law school. And I loved it. I actually loved Grand Forks, North Dakota. It was a wonderful place. It's not what you expect, but it's actually a great place to live too. So especially, you know, I had two kids at the time. So
you know, on this program, people talk about the country, the way the country's divided, this and that. To me, the country isn't divided racially, and anybody who's old enough to know what bad race relations are will tell you that if you're confusing, if you say race relations are getting worse, then in my opinion, you don't know shit about this country. The number one demographic that's expanding is mixed race people, young children, right? That means we're getting along, you know, in ways we never really got along before. And, you know, in spite of what our national news would lead you to believe. But I would say where the divide is small town America versus large town America. Two different ways of living. One provides for themselves. They look for themselves. Their neighbors, they're involved in their communities. And another large town America is a different way of living. And I think they expect government to provide them services. And so, in my opinion, there's no doubt which is better. And Grand Forks, North Dakota, it's kind of a big small town at 63,000 people or not something. But Colby and I both live there, probably not too far from each other. And then if you were going to UND. What about, give us your path up to your involvement in the Haditha case, Colby.
Sure. Well, I wanted to become a lawyer because I wanted to try cases, prosecute, and defend. And I didn't really have any interest in any other legal jobs, SJA, or you name it in there. So along the way, once I got through with law school and going through the Naval Justice School, I was just kind of advocating to be in trial billets the whole time. So that's what I did. So all I did as a lawyer was prosecute and defend, other than I got my LLM in between there.
Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, my master's of law.
Okay.
So I went through the Army's JAG school in Charlottesville, Virginia is teamed up with the University of Virginia Law School. So you go there and, I got my master's of law with a specialty in criminal law and, it's actually a really good year of education. The Army School is superior, and of course you've got the University of Virginia Law School, which is part of it, which is just, you know, phenomenal, one of the top law schools in the country. So, really good program, really good education. So, other than that, all I did was courtroom jobs. And, you know, as you get promoted and move up, there's fewer and fewer litigation jobs. For judge advocates, it's usually for, you know, lieutenants, captains, and majors. But I wanted to stay in the courtroom. And, I love defending Marines. I did like prosecuting, but I like defense a whole lot better.
Why?
Well, I think part of it is, and part of what drives me, I think, drove me to be a lawyer, is I don't like bullies. So you see cases where in the military where they're prosecuting somebody, they're not certainly not always, but sometimes you can see people going over the top trying to get someone, and that kind of pisses me off. And, you know, when an organization brings their full weight to bear, you need to have somebody there to defend the Marines. And I got to tell you, now that I'm retired, and I still do mostly military cases, but I do other cases as well, there's no better client in the world to have than the United States Marine. I mean, who better work defending, even if somebody has done something wrong, than the United States Marine? So I like the defense. So for my last duty station in the Marine Corps, which I stretched out to 5 years, I was the regional defense counsel out of Camp Pendleton. So I was in charge of all the Marine and a few Navy defense attorneys in the west half of the U.S. and in Iraq. So it was while I was in that job is when a bunch of cases came up, including the Hamdaniya cases and the Haditha cases.
What is the... What's the responsibility of the regional defense counsel? So these cases come to you. What's your role in them?
I am the supervisor for all the defense counsel. I'm responsible for training them. I evaluate them. So all the fitness reports go through me. I'm their ethics supervisor, and I took all those responsibilities pretty seriously, especially the training. So when it came to, I'd say in about 2003, 2004, when we start getting these war crimes kind of cases coming in and certain allegations, I knew that this was going to be a big deal going forward. So starting in about 2005 or so, I started doing PMEs with lawyers in my region, and I started making them read books and actually writing book reports, which I know they hated me for. So not like they didn't have enough work, but so they all had to. We all had to study My Lai, Son Thang, which is, you know, the kind of the Marine Corps version of My Lai in Vietnam, and we would study a lot of military justice history. The Ribbon Creek incident, and what I wanted them to do is understand how these cases, you know, how cases are prosecuted. What are the factors that go into it? That way, when one of these cases come up, they're going to be more prepared on understanding how to properly defend them. Where is the command coming from in prosecuting them? Where's the objections to prosecuting these things? There's a lot of moral issues that you end up discussing too. I mean, just the fact of prosecuting, you know, a Marine for killing the enemy in combat, there'd be a huge moral discussion just around that topic.
Right.
How do you do that? And the more confusing the war becomes, the more difficult it should be to decide to prosecute somebody like that.
I would have thought, their workload aside, I would have thought that they would have loved that, because, you know, you're getting a chance to study. In my study of those cases, and I haven't got into the Song Sang one at all, it's riveting. Not only what drove the events, right, all the different factors that went into them, the institutional initial response, which is largely disbelief and nothing really happened, then as a kind of something, there will be some event that triggers something. Sometimes it's broader public exposure in the national media. Other times it goes across somebody's desk and they begin the investigation. But all the different missteps along the way, I would think, man, I mean, this is a great opportunity to get savvy on how the institution works, how we approach it legally, what my role would be in that. I would think that would be something that I would want to do. I'd have been all about it, man.
No, I think they were. I just don't think they were crazy about the book reports.
Right. The
But it was serious stuff, and I saw this coming up, and I wanted them to spend a lot of time, you know, thinking about it. So, and I think it turns out I was right. So,
all right, real quickly, lightning round questions. When you think of Mili, give me the number one thought that comes into your head when you think of that case.
Great difference in opinion as to the nature of that crime.
Great difference of opinion as to the nature of that crime. Explain that. Give me a couple footnotes to that so I can understand it.
So Mili was arguably one of, if not the worst, war crime massacre case in U.S. military history. Yet, despite that, in the conviction of Cowley and the life sentence, there was a huge outpouring of support for Cowley and fighting against his sentence, so that he didn't end up doing that life imprisonment. He did house arrest and was granted clemency later on.
Right.
So, you know, why the two? Matter of fact, recently, one of the prosecutors from that case was just recommended. It was just recognized. I think it was just last week or so, or 2 weeks ago.
Saw that.
And he still says that he still thinks Cowley should have been life in prison. And when you look at the offense and what happened there, and the death of all those people, it's easy to look at it and just say, "Oh, that's one of the most horrific war crimes of all time. How could anybody support Cowley?" Yet.
Right.
There was a huge amount of support. There was congressional support for Cowley. There was a huge number of citizens who wanted to support Cowley.
Yeah, I want to say at one point Nixon was getting something like 20,000 letters a day about Cowley.
And this is not to say that Cowley didn't do anything wrong, but right. This is to say that it's like people were thinking. But how do we judge what these men do in combat when you're faced with an impossible task? Now, you won't ever get me saying that I didn't think Cowley did anything wrong. I think he did. But when you take that all into context, I think you kind of get a greater understanding of some of the moral conflicts here of charging somebody with murder for operating in a combat zone. And I think that's what people fail to understand. Of why people, you know, why would so many people still be supportive of Cowley after what had happened?
I would tell you though that in fact I had a conversation recently with a friend of mine. Do you know Mike Musselman? He was a division gunner, got out probably 3 years ago, in the 1st Marine Division. I don't know if you ever crossed paths with him, but Mike and I were talking about the difference between murder and killing in combat. And I might have relayed this to you a week ago when we talked. And he said, you know, that's not a thin line for most of us as professionals. You know, and I'm not talking about somebody who gets killed by a stray round. But the difference between killing in combat and murder, pretty big difference. So I think professionals, when they hear you say that, what I feel is like, well, yeah, they're civilians. They don't know. You know, there's been people that have done things that I personally read the investigations, and I came home and I heard what was getting said by Michael Savage. I wound up listening to him one day, and I listened to it, and I almost drove off the road. I'm like, no, that's it. He murdered. Michael Savage is talking about how the Marine Corps is on a witch hunt. They want to nail this kid to a tree. Blah 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 blah. And I'm like, you know. They just don't. They don't understand it. They're not professionals. They don't know what's going on in the war, and so they see a young American put into this position, and then they hear this. Well, you can't tell anybody apart, and they're all doing this, you know. And then I guess if you're not there, yeah, you would believe that. So I can. It makes sense, except it doesn't make sense to us. Does that make sense? Those of us who do it.
I don't think it's, I do think that there is a thin line between them. And, I think to say that there's a, you know, it's night and day difference between murder and lawful killing, I also think is not looking at it deep enough and how these things end up being convictions in the first place. So, for example, I represent a guy named Sergeant Michael Williams, Army. This is one I did after I retired, and he was the very first war crimes conviction out of the OAF OEF. And what was happening is they were fighting house to house, and there was an insurgent who was involved in the battle who had been shooting at him and runs into a house. And Williams and his guys proceed into the house, pointed to find the guy, and he's sitting there and he's sweating, and he had set his weapon down, so he's not an immediate threat, but Williams shot him anyway. Now, under the rules of engagement, he had PID on the guy, but he did not have, there was no hostile intent at the time he shot him.
Right.
So if that's the case, and he didn't, in accordance to the rules of engagement, he, you know, violated the rules of engagement, that means legally then he didn't have justification for the killing.
Okay.
Therefore, he's guilty of murder. But when you put somebody in that position of you're fighting house to house, you don't know who the enemy is, everything's moving fast, and all the guy does is uses the rules of engagement to avoid being killed when he's clearly the enemy. And I'm not saying that makes that shooting okay or proper, but at the same time, you can understand how somebody in that situation might go in there and pull that trigger.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think one of the injustices comes here with a lot of these cases is when they walk in and they decide to charge someone with premeditated murder for that, which is what happens often in military justice. So, I mean, you think of premeditated murder, you think of the people who plan something out, or, you know, we're going to go rob the store and shoot the clerk, or this person really angers me. And, you know, premeditated murder receives the harshest punishments known to law. And that's because of that criminal intent somebody has. In this case with Michael Williams, his intent is to kill the enemy. It's a lawful intent.
But it's not premeditated. How could he be charged like that? I mean, it happens, boom.
Because premeditation under the law takes a very short time. There's no definite time of premeditation. It can be as little as 1 second. That if you intend to kill somebody. So this is what happens. This is not what happened in Haditha, because they did not charge premeditated. But it happens in a great number of these cases. And the significance of that is because when you charge somebody with premeditated murder, if you fight it and lose, it's a mandatory minimum life sentence. So it is incredible pressure for somebody to plead guilty, not to fight it, because they're using that intent to kill, which you lawfully have, really kind of against them. So it seems patently unfair to charge somebody like Michael Williams with premeditated murder, when it was at one of those decisions you make just right off the bat and you're in combat. But that's exactly what happens. So these guys are being charged with the same crimes, that, you know, some people do some pretty horrific things do.
But I wouldn't call
and
that, I would not call that, I wouldn't even categorize that as murder, Colby. I mean, did he make an ROE mistake? Yes. Right? He's fighting the enemy, right? Right. The guy's a combatant, yes? Yes. Okay. Should he have taken another step and yes. Murder? I don't think so. You know?
Well, and I would agree with you. I just got through doing a clemency hearing for a man named Sergeant Derek Miller, and he was out in Afghanistan in 2011.
Can you explain legally clemency?
Yes. Clemency is after a court martial happens, if someone's found guilty, you have the right to go initially to the convening authority, so whichever general or admiral has run in the case, who ordered the case, and ask for some kind of leniency, maybe a reduction in a sentence or something like that. Once usually you don't get anything. But after that case is completed, and you go through the appeals, and once you go through the whole appeals process, and the appeals process is over, you still have another opportunity at clemency. Clemency and parole, and you're going through the, for example, in this case, was the Army Clemency and Parole Board. So this is, again, 7 years after his conviction, and I go up to the Army Clemency and Parole Board in the Crystal City, Virginia there, and you're asking that his sentence be reduced. Now, Derek was one of these guys who, he was in Afghanistan, and the day before he had seen this one guy who was suspicious. They thought that papers must have been false when they were going to a checkpoint. The next day, they see him again, and this time he's walking through their lines, and he is saying that he is a plumber, but he didn't have any tools yesterday, he didn't have any tools today, and you know how that goes. When you ask somebody what they do, they lie all the time about what they do. Just like if in Haditha, you ask, you go through and ask anybody in Haditha, they're all engineers. And if you believe that, it's got the highest per capita rate of engineers in the world in the city of Haditha. But, the guy lied about being a plumber. So he ended up, reporting that, and they said, we'll question him again. Now the guy says he's an electrician again, has no tools. And what Derek, thought he was, and end up he was right, was that this guy was just scouting the lines for a Taliban attack on this army unit. And so Derek is questioning him. He's got his pistol out, and he's with the interpreter, and he's yelling at him, tell me when the attack's coming, tell me when the attack's coming. And at some point, the guy grabs for his weapon, and there's a struggle, and Derek shoots him and kills him. So in that case, there was only two witnesses, the interpreter, who didn't say anything until he was granted passage to the U.S., and then the one other Army soldier who, his initial two statements said that, yeah, there was a struggle and Derek shot him, and then he was threatened with charges of accessory, and it was going to be denied his R&R to go on his honeymoon, so then he changed his statement. So the case goes to trial, and it was defended very well by Charlie Gittins, a military attorney, but he was found guilty. And because he was charged with premeditated murder, the jury's got no option whatsoever. They have to sentence him to at least life. He's going to get life or life without possibility of parole. He got life.
That's crazy.
Now, in that case, and we don't know why the jury found him guilty. They may have said, look, he was entitled to defend himself in this, but not with the weapon. Maybe it was excessive self-defense. Therefore, you don't have the self-defense. And, maybe that's why they found him guilty. I mean, it could be they didn't believe him, but I don't know why they decided what they did. But under the law, if he does something to lose that legal defense of self-defense, he's therefore guilty. So, again, we don't know why the jury decided what they decided, but to charge someone like that with premeditated murder,
that's bullshit.
To me seems
crazy. It's it's crazy.
Welcome to my world.
No, it's like that's not. Look, let me tell you what happened in Hamdiya. That's murder,
right?
Okay, planet. You know, you're pissed. You know, that's murder. Right, and that's to me, that's the thick line. What you're talking about, that's not even murder to those of us who have done it. You know? And it sounds like, now again, I haven't seen any of the statements or any of these things, but, so as somebody who spent almost 3 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, that's not murder. That's the gray area that insurgents live in, and sometimes things go bad in it, but it's not murder. And
it's very similar to what Alan West did without the shooting part. So, and to make matters worse, Derek was absolutely right. So after this incident, and the unit all buttoned up, got in their Bradleys, and what, 30 minutes later, 45 minutes later, they get attacked by the Taliban. So Derek put them on alert, and Derek was absolutely right. It was a precursor to an assault by the Taliban on their unit.
All right, let's switch gears. All right. No, so we agree. You're citing for me what I would say. Those are anomalies. That's bullshit. That's and when you watch in Haditha, the way that the convening authority, which is Secretary Mattis at the time as the head of MARSENT, the commanding general of MARSENT, when you look at his standard for the difficulty that young Marines encounter in an insurgent-led war, where the insurgent picks a time and a place, you see a completely different standard of understanding and I would say compassion than what you're describing to me. What you're describing to me is wrong-headed and inappropriate given the war that we were fighting.
Sure.
And so with those footnotes, could you then grant me that, yeah, Mac, I can understand where you would see a thicker line if Hamdiya is your example, and, you know, the other one, the Pitano thing, if those are your examples, then I can understand that. Because as a professional, what you're describing to me, that's not murder. So I
understand. Yes, I do. I do recognize that. And I think in most people's minds, until they face that situation, they can say, you know, I absolutely see a difference between, you know, there's a huge difference between, you know, murder and a lawful shooting in combat.
Right.
And I would say that sometimes you may not have been in that one situation.
Right.
So,
no, I'm with you.
What if you're a junior Marine and you're ordered to shoot in a confusing situation? The guy who's making that decision, you know, I'm looking about Hamdaniya with Sergeant Hutchins, and he's the one who hashes his plan. And what if you're one of the junior guys who's just following the orders? Is it clearly in lawful order or not? And that can be a fine line too.
Right. Now, I think one of the saddest statements I read about that, was from one of the corporals, and he when it all came apart. His statement read, or the interrogation that they did with him, he was asked, "You knew this was wrong. Why didn't you stop it?" And he said, and I'm obviously paraphrasing here, "You have to understand, I fought with these guys in Fallujah and now here, you know, in Iraq a second time. They've saved my life. I've saved their lives. There's nobody closer to me on the planet than these guys." And when he brought it up, I said, "I'm not doing that." And he looked at me and said, "What are you, a fucking pussy?" And so they gave me a different job. I wasn't going to be a part of the killing. But I did know it was wrong and I should have stopped it. But it's not that easy. These are my guys. And I think in that statement, you hear, right, the conflict. And does that excuse it? No. Should he have stopped it? Yes. And then ultimately, the next question was it worth it? Was it worth 7 years of your life and all of this? No. I should have stopped it. I know that now. That's not what I felt at the time. And you see this incredible conflict of, but, you know, again, we need to do a better job teaching why you keep your honor clean, in my opinion, on the front side, so that when you do cross paths with these kind of situations, you hear it booming in your head. I'm going to have to live with this shit for the rest of my life. It's not going away. And I know a little bit about what happened at My Lai and places like Haditha, and I know my responsibility, not only to myself, but to all these guys, too. Yeah, we're not doing it. So just...
Well, there's also something else you can pull from Hamdaniya, which I think we would both agree was an unlawful action. But even with that, you had huge outpouring of support and protests against the prosecution of the Pendleton 8. And when these guys go to trial, a bunch of them plead guilty. Well, there's a few things you can take from this. Is when you face such serious charges as premeditated murder, people will say anything, and the whole thing of getting somebody to testify against another can be a very distasteful business, because people will either can lie, they can alter their They can exaggerate. They can it changes.
Right.
So you're not necessarily getting the absolute truth when you're getting people to testify against others. So and the other thing is with this support and think about what they did in Tanzania, and we would all agree that you can't do what Sergeant Hutchins and his crew did. Yet look at the results of what happened. There were three of them that fought that case. Hutchins got 15 years for unpremeditated murder. And his case was overturned and when later tried, ended up getting a time served. The two corporals who pled not guilty and fought it got convicted of lesser offenses. Neither one of them got any break time, and one didn't even get a BCD. He walked out with an honorable discharge. I think he was the only one of the whole eight that actually walked out with an honorable discharge. So you got to ask yourself, when it was clearly something wrong, why, and we're talking about military juries, why are they deciding what they're doing? Because they're wrestling with those same moral problems that we wrestle with these cases all the time. And I'm telling you, when General Mattis was appointing members for those panels for those courts martial, his emphasis was to make sure that the guys that sat on those court martials had real combat experience. So he wanted people who had been at, you know, both ends of the gun in combat to assess this, what was right and what was wrong, and also to assess, you know, what kind of punishment is appropriate. So despite that they were charged with premeditated murder, you didn't have anybody convicted of premeditated murder. You had unpremeditated murder in the case of the corporals, assault charges. So, and that is rational, educated, experienced combat Marines who are in there in the courtroom making that decision. Right. And you got to ask yourself why.
Right.
So,
well, you know, you just gave me another topic for another show. The my guest is retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Colby Vokey. And initially joined the Marine Corps as an artilleryman, became a staff judge advocate, and was a principal in the Haditha case. Hey, do we need to take a break as we switch gears and turn to Haditha? Do you need a couple minutes? Go get something to drink? Take a leak? Anything like that?
No.
Okay.
I'm good.
All right, let's talk about Haditha. How do you hear about it in your role as regional defense counsel? How do you hear about it, and talk to me about the initial parts of your involvement?
Sure. Well, Haditha and Tanzania, the word came down roughly about the same time. Tanzania was a little easier because they threw those guys in pretrial confinement, so we know those are starting right away. But we were also hearing rumors about something that happened in Haditha, and we knew that was 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines. So having this strong feeling and rumor that there's something coming down from Haditha, and we'd seen some of the press coverage on it, I kind of knew that something big is coming down. So what I would do is I would have my defense counsel make sure they all go eat in the chow hall, there at Camp Horno and Camp Pendleton, you know, go to the subway and ask questions and see if they can just talk to people from 3-1 to see if anybody knows anything about it. So we did that, and one of the first people we came in contact with was Captain Luke McConnell. So that's how we brought him in. That's how we started trying to identify who was likely going to be implicated in this. We still don't know if they were going to be charged or not, but just trying to do a little prep work and trying to get our kind of hands around what might be coming. So we ended up identifying kind of who the players were and starting to reach out to them. Now, in the military, you can't assign a counsel to anyone until they're either confined or, you know, pretrial restraint or they're charged. So what we did when we reached out and found these guys, we immediately started to have them contact different civilian attorneys. We would suggest some, tell them they can hire whoever they want, but providing you some names and numbers of people that we believe had experience with these kind of cases. So we were doing that right off the bat. Interesting enough, there were some of these guys who, like Sergeant Wooderich, who his first sergeant told him right off the bat, don't talk to anybody, call a lawyer right away. So and that was before we even knew anything about it. So I think that's an important lesson of whether you've done something wrong, if you're innocent, or if you've done something wrong, you don't want to make any statements. And I get this advice from everybody from privates to admirals and generals when they call, which is, if you've done something wrong, don't make a statement. If you're innocent, for the love of God, don't make a statement. And, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive for us in the military because, you know, we need to say what we've seen.
Right.
But when you start being accused of something, that's the worst thing you can do, especially if you're innocent. So we got these guys in contact with certain civilian attorneys. And so by the time that they decided to charge these guys and it came down, we had already, I think every one of them had some kind of civilian counsel representation. And we'd also identified who was going to represent whom on the military side. And yet a member we had, you know, Camp Pendleton is the busiest trial section in the Marine Corps anyway. We had a capital murder case in Miramar. And so we had a full caseload anyway. And then you bring down two war crimes cases at the same time. It's incredible. So, you know, with so many people charged with murder, and you got to make sure you got the right, you know, that these guys are capable of defending them. So it was a huge task. But by the time they were even charged, we already identified which military council was going to represent which accused. We had things worked out, conflicts worked out. We even had a different regional defense counsel who was going to be the supervisor for the Haditha cases alone because I was going to represent Staff Sergeant Wooderich. So we brought in Phil Simmons in that role. So a lot of prep work, make sure that, you know, legally to avoid conflicts and make sure everything is ready so when Marine Corps was ready to charge these guys, we were ready to start defending.
All right. So what's in the media, though, the Time Magazine article is really explodes with the images that explodes this into the American public. And so I call it the time before that kind of the internal phase of this, where it was a Marine Corps event, and then after that, kind of the external phase of that. As the defense guy, Colby, what are your biggest concerns as you see this? I think you have, you know, you studied history already and then had your guys study it. You preparing for, you know, God forbid something like this, but you'd seen in history, you know, other cases like this. What were your thoughts? What did you think your duty was to these Marines?
We were in defending these Marines till every time, last breath that we had in our bodies. And you're not talking about a me lie, where somebody walked in with something that appeared to be clearly wrong. And you're not even talking about harm to neither. You're talking about guys who were in a high-pressure situation. They've been attacked. In the case of Wooders and his guys, have been ordered to clear houses. And keep in mind that the action there at Haditha was only part one of coordinated attacks by insurgents across the city the whole rest of the day. So we were determined, you know, these guys are not going to get convicted of this. That's what we were determined to do. So we had a lot of coordination amongst the teams and the defendants, and that was important. So
the coordination between defense counsels was important.
It is. You know, sometimes you can't do it depending on certain kinds of cases, but if you can. If defense is aligned, then that's something that you want to do. And it can be very important because of this pressure of trying to make someone roll on somebody else. And I mentioned before, sometimes when you offer a plea agreement and tell somebody they don't have to go to jail for the rest of their life or they give them some kind of deal, people sometimes, unfortunately, even Marines will say whatever it takes, depending on how, you know, big the threat is. And nothing illustrates that better than what happened in Haditha, when they finally gave immunity to several of these guys.
Okay, can I explain some stuff for us? Because, you know, Neil Puckett was on twice, you know, I want to say maybe for as long as 3.5 hours when you combine the two interviews. So the events happen in November of 2005. Statements are made. Talk to us about the initial statements that are made. When are those made, and were they lawful statements? Did everybody get their rights read to them? Did they understand them? You know, and tell me about the initial statements that are made.
Well, there ended up being several investigations. One, you had NCIS investigating. And then you also had a command investigation, and the focus of that was mainly Lieutenant Colonel Chisani and Camp McConnell and the reporting of this and the handling of it. So there were kind of two investigations, although for the Marines that are being questioned, it's a blur to them what interview is what. All they know is they're being asked questions. So.
Okay, and just for clarification, who's doing the command investigation? Is it Mark Sent that's doing it? Is it 2MATH? Who's doing the command investigation?
That was Mark Sent. I believe it was Mark Sent. It might have been CENTCOM. I'd have to go back and look at it.
Okay, all right.
And there were a number of people doing questioning, so it was a very confusing time. So a lot of people asking a lot of questions. And again, Sergeant Woodridge made statements in the command investigation, but not in the NCIS investigation, because the first sergeant told them, hey, you need to talk to a lawyer, which was great advice by that first sergeant, for sure.
When is this taking place? Have they redeployed now in the spring of 2006 and they're making statements, or are these statements being made while they're still in country?
While they're still in country.
Okay. All right. And so that's when we hear all the NCIS agents kind of descending on the dam at Haditha and doing their questioning there.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. All right. All right. So those initial statements get made, and then they redeploy, and everybody lawyers up, yes, in the sequence of events?
That's right.
Okay, so now nobody else is saying anything.
Yeah, now some did make statements. So some of the Marines did make statements to NCIS. Woodridge did not, but some did.
After they came home?
No. Just to NCIS while they're over there.
While they're over there. Okay. So, but once they came home, nobody else, there's no more, they lawyer up and nobody else makes any more statements.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Now here's my next question is I'm going to ask you to step outside your own body. So, kind of hover over yourself, if you will.
All right.
In trying to understand what happened at Haditha, the way it was prosecuted, to me, you look at the evidence, and now we have to decide what charges we're going to bring. I'm not a lawyer. I do play one on the radio. The standard for me is what can I prove, right? Not what do I think happened, what might have happened, but what can I walk in there and convince a jury to convict somebody with? Yes?
Right, correct.
And so it seems to me that most of this is not, I can't prove it. Like I can, like, other than what they've admitted to in their own statements, right? Are these guys gonna testify against each other? And I guess that's when we start getting into immunity and who we're going to, you know, immunize and who we're not and whatnot. But the standard is what I can prove, and then creating a strategy where we are going to that we're going to execute as a prosecution team. I don't, when I look at it, I don't rightly understand what they did. As the defense guy, was there any doubt in your mind? I asked this to Neil, and I'm not going to tell you what he said, but that these guys were not going to jail for murder?
Was there any doubt in my mind? Sure, absolutely.
There was. Okay.
Yeah. Well, look, because what you're describing of you're going to charge based on what you can prove and what the evidence initially looks like is also a little bit of a naive approach, because there's so many other external influences on this. I mean, you got to remember President Bush went on national television addressing this twice. You have national and international coverage of this incident. You have Congressman Murtha, who used this as part of his anti-war platform,
right,
claiming these Marines killed in cold blood.
Right.
So if you got a well-respected, long-standing U.S. congressman saying he's got it from the highest authority that these Marines killed in cold blood, is that going to affect your decision on what you charge these guys with? Absolutely.
No, I'm a professional. Somebody's got to be the adult in the room. If we're all just going to be bobbleheads, then we're going to fight wars that we shouldn't fight. We're going to expand wars that we shouldn't expand, and we're going to be a shit show. At some point, there's got to be adults that look and say, hey, I can't prove that. Like, I got it. Everybody's on board, but this is where the rubber meets the road, boys and girls. And I can't prove that.
Well,
I don't give a shit what John Murtha says or what George Bush says. I'm gonna look like a jackass when I walk in there and I can't prove that.
Well, put it this way. NCIS had two separate reporting chains for what was going on. So you have the investigators who are working on the case reporting a certain way, and then another reporting chain that went to NCIS headquarters.
Okay.
You had the Secretary of Defense stood up a special cell to monitor this.
Whoa.
So you are having a lot of people demanding information, and there's also information coming down from those chains. So, and you know, you're talking about the military justice system where the prosecutor prosecutes the case, but he's not the one who decides whether the case goes forward or not. So, whereas in the DA's office, the DA can dismiss it. That's not the same thing in military justice. The convening authority must dismiss it. So there are so many different influences in this process, not to mention all the publicity that's happening. So there are big external and internal pressures that are happening. And you'll have even people within the Marine Corps, you'll have some people standing up and saying, hey, these guys did nothing wrong, and some people may be standing up and saying, hey, this is just like Tom DiNio or something else. So there's a lot of different dialogue like that's occurring. So, and you can't ignore public pressure. So I think fortunately for the Marine Corps, we had a convening authority who was less immune to those kind of pressures. But, you know, when we had General Mattis, but at the same time, when the President of the United States, the Commander in Chief, is pushing on an issue, I mean, he is the Commander in Chief. When Secretary Rumsfeld is demanding answers and sending down missiles, those are things that they just can't ignore. So I think the reality is that the more high visit is, the more other pressures come to bear on it.
Interesting.
And I think,
see, in my mind, I see these attorneys as having these kind of almost imperial discussions, empirical discussions, and that those influences outside the courtroom don't really come into play, or we can discuss them when we're going to talk about charging, but at some point, right, we got to fish or cut bait, right? The rubber has to meet the road, and that's got to be about what we can actually prove in the courtroom, and not about all the extraneous shit that surrounds this case. I mean, I think that would turn you into a neurotic. And so, okay. All right. Interesting. So they begin to immunize. I want to talk about your thoughts on that whole process and the effect on ultimately the outcome as they begin to immunize the Marines that had been charged initially. So there's 8 charged initially, and talk to us about that whole process of plea deals and immunity and what ultimately they line up to, which is Staff Sergeant Woodridge.
Absolutely. So, I think they charged initially also not knowing who was responsible, which is not uncommon. Because when you first charge somebody, you don't have all of the evidence. And you gotta remember when you're prosecuting, the prosecutors always know less information than the defense does because the defense has the client. So, oftentimes they will overcharge, or sometimes they will charge in the alternative. Like, we don't know if this was, it was charged either, maybe this was a manslaughter, maybe this was a murder, so we'll just charge both and we'll sort it out as we go through the trial process. That's pretty common because oftentimes you don't know and you want to account for variations in the evidence as it can come out. But, in this case, when they charged everyone with murder, all the shooters, a lot of interesting things happened, and this is one of the dirty parts of military justice, or really any criminal justice, is getting people to cooperate and roll over on someone else. And we often hear about jailhouse snitches in the civilian world. Some guy says, "Oh yeah, he confessed to me in prison," and the prosecutors put those people up, and they're some of the most despicable people, and some of the most questionable evidence that we ever offer. This isn't quite that bad, but sometimes it's pretty bad. And when you charge somebody with such a serious offense, there's all the incentive in the world for them to say something to get out. And sometimes people just outright lie, and sometimes people just kind of change, the story just a little bit to fit what the prosecutor wants so that they can get the deal that they're hoping for. So that's just a reality that happens all the time. And people have to realize that goes on. So in this case, You had shootings in different places in Haditha. You had, so right after the IED went off, they engaged, the men in the white car that was right next to where they were.
Right.
After that, Lieutenant Calip ordered Woodridge to go clear those houses. So he goes and clears house one and then house two. And then later on, after that it was over, they went over and, went to what's known as house four. And there was some shooting there. So Woodridge and some of the Marines either were charged with the shooting of the white car, house one, house two, and house four. At least initially, that's how it came down.
Right.
So when it came to the roadside shooting of the white car, there were two people they were looking at. It was Sergeant Dela Cruz and Staff Sergeant Woodridge. Now, Dela Cruz was one of the first people that they immunized, and that was a huge mistake, and you can see this happening going along because Dela Cruz's statement, I think they were so eager to get some information against Woodridge that Dela Cruz's statement about what he did in the roadside shooting there with the white car made absolutely no sense. And I think they did a poor job of questioning Dela Cruz's version of events and too eager to get somebody who would testify against Woodridge because his story was so incredible. And, just completely lacked credibility that it ended up being kind of a joke later on. So Dela Cruz saying that, he fired the guys at roadside, but only after they were dead and that Woodridge had shot them and that, he demonstrated how he shot them because he knew there was a problem with if he was shooting these guys, even though once they were dead, that there would be stippling on there. So he demonstrates in the courtroom that he raises his M16 above his arms when he shoots these supposedly already dead people. And it just made no sense. And there were a lot of things like that with Dela Cruz that made no sense. And it quickly became clear that they were just doing something to try to get Wooderich on that. And the ironic thing is that Wooderich, the forensic NCIS guys, Maloney and Brady, didn't even think Wooderich initially could have been the ones who shot the guys at the roadside. That it had to have been Dela Cruz just because of the angles, and Dela Cruz was a whole lot closer. And if it weren't for the 60 Minutes interview, there's a good chance that those roadside charges against Wooderich would have been dropped early on. So you didn't have Dela Cruz getting immunity to testify against Wooderich. But the real problem came when you get into House 1 and House 2. And each one of these different times that they're charging are kind of completely different situations, although all the way through House 2 is one kind of fluid movement by these Marines. But each scene individually, you have to look at it differently.
Okay.
So House 1 was the house they were receiving fire from, that Wooderich went in there, and they just cleared the house like they'd been trained, stacked along the walls, threw grenades, and clear by fire, and they moved on to House 2. And one of the mistakes in this case may have been charging so many of these different incidents. So I think in retrospect, going back, I bet you the prosecutors, if they could, they would limit this the improper shootings just to House 2, because that's certainly the one with the most problems. But as they move through the case and it progresses, they then immunize Mendoza. So Mendoza now has immunity, and he's going to be testifying, and his evidence really condemns Tatum, Lance Corporal Tatum.
Right.
A little bit Wooderich, but certainly Tatum. And then right before Tatum's going to go to trial, they immunize Tatum so that, of course, Tatum now had to say terrible things about Wooderich, about the shooting in House 2. And the problem with all that is all these guys immunizing, in order for them to be not guilty in their statements, they have to implicate certain other people, the people that the prosecutors want.
Right.
And in this case, especially with Mendoza and Tatum, their stories cannot coexist. It's not a matter of one perceives it different than the other. Their stories could not coexist because Mendoza says it was Tatum that was in there firing and saying certain things. And when Tatum later gets immunity, now he's saying it was Wooderich that was in there shooting. So those two statements can't coexist. How do you give immunity to those two guys when you know at least one of them has to be lying? And what do you do with that? Do you now put them both on the witness stand and kind of let God sort it out? Or are you knowingly putting some perjured testimony? You don't know which one's perjured, but you're putting perjured testimony up on the stand. That's a hell of a problem. So, you know, safe to say the two versions from Mendoza and from Tatum, and easy to see how you could impeach either one of them, but they cannot be, both those stories cannot be true. So the decision to immunize both of them was a bad one from the prosecutors. Now, I've heard, you know, rumor of people suggest that perhaps the Marine Corps did not want to convict any of these guys, and that's why these decisions were made. I think that's ludicrous.
Right, I do too. I don't buy the conspiracy theory that there was some grand right hand in all of this, choreographing events at the beginning that were going to lead to a certain outcome. I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I do too. And look, General Mattis was, you know, the initial convening authority for both Hamdani and Haditha. And while I don't always agree with everything that General Mattis did or said, and I have a lot of dealings with him when I was in the Marine Corps, both good and bad. He got really pissed at me once and wanted to order me to Iraq, but that's a whole other story. But I think as far as convening authorities go and trying to sort this mess out, and he's receiving all kinds of information from all kinds of people, I think he did a pretty fair job of trying to sort this out and making fair decisions. So, for example, in the military justice system, if you need an expert witness, it's almost like you military, everyone is considered to be almost like indigent. So if you need an expert witness, you request that person through the prosecutor, and it goes up to the convening authority. And if it's denied, then you have to file a motion with the judge and convince the court that it's a necessary person. So in one occasion, sending a expert request on Woodridge's case, and it was denied by General Mattis after going through the prosecutors. Obviously, the prosecutors recommended against it. They always do. Mattis himself called me up and said, look, I denied this expert, but if you really need it, I'm still open to discussion on it. And I said, no, General, that's right. We've got it covered. We figured it out a different way, but thank you. You know, to have someone serve as a convening authority to actually pick up the phone and call a defense counsel on something like this is unheard of. I've never seen that in my entire career. So you won't convince me that Mattis had some grand scheme to make this case go one result or the other. I think he was in a constant battle of getting competing information from his own people and tried to sort through what that meant.
And I would tell you this, having worked for him, just as you were aware of history, he was similarly aware of history in terms of in terms of Mili and the way major court martials have been handled and screwed up. And knowing him and having worked for him very closely, he would be determined that this thing would be handled appropriately. And justice would be served. Wherever that would take us, it would be served. And he would not flinch from that one for 1 second. And he would do everything, including calling you, to make sure that the Marines were treated fairly and that it happened appropriately. But what I see, Colby, though, is there's on the exterior of this, there's tremendous pressure. Okay. In the interior of it, As you're going through statement, right? Decision to immunize, looking at these statements together, what they mean, right? Even a novice defense attorney would look at that and say, they're handing me the ammunition that I need to defeat these charges. They're handing it to me, and I haven't even seen an NCIS investigation yet. So that's what perplexes me about the case, the pleas, the immunizations. It's almost like they're undermining their case as they go.
Well, yeah, but I don't think they realize that. Matter of fact, I think what they thought they were doing is building up this an absolute strong, impenetrable case against Woodridge. Because when they first started, it wasn't all about Woodridge. Towards the end, it became all about Woodridge. And the problem with that is, if Woodridge is not the monster that they're trying to make him out to be, then you know, you sold the farm, and that's problematic. And now it's almost like trying to fit a round peg into a square hole. So,
which ultimately turns out to be the case, yes?
Yeah, absolutely.
At the end of the day, it's a round peg trying to be a square peg trying to be shoved into a round hole, and it just won't fit. And after all of this, you know, Cesar Woodridge pleads guilty to one count of negligent dereliction of duty. Yes.
Yes, the least serious offense in all of the UCMJ.
Okay, and that's absolutely, positively amazing. And so as I looked at this and I tried to understand, and the reason, Colby, I wanted to have you on is trying to get the lessons learned. What should have happened? What would have been appropriate to happen? And to me, if we could somehow or other wall off this pressure and look at the statements and sit down and have an honest discussion about, I shouldn't say honest discussion, because I don't want to, you know, it's not a dishonest discussion if you just simply come out to a different conclusion. And if we have a very, very straightforward discussion about all of these statements, what they're going to testify, and if we get Volke's twin to sit in here and talk to us about what we're doing for him and war game this thing, I think if we go down that road of only getting Woodridge, we're going to lose. We can't win. there's too much for them to use in his defense. And that's before the NCIS investigation comes in with all the forensics and all that, right? And so then you pile the NCIS thing and you look at this, and there's no way you're going to be convicted. And so what are we left with? Charging everybody with a single count of negligent dereliction of duty and giving them general discharges? Would that be the other course of action? Because you can't prove it.
Well, it is very difficult. And, of course, it's not uncommon in prosecutions when you first start off and you don't know everything you can prove yet. So
right.
You've got an idea. This is what the evidence suggests. But, again, that's why prosecutors regularly charge things in the alternative to see how the evidence is going to come out. So it is not an easy decision. And I don't want to make it sound like the prosecutors didn't put any thought into it, because they had lots of discussions. Matter of fact, it's my understanding that there was a lot of internal conflict within the prosecution team, this special team that they formed.
And just for the record, I've never seen anything written by any one of those, anybody involved in the prosecution, about the rationale behind it. I would love to have somebody come on and do things that, relative to this and explain the difficulties of it. Because at the end of the day, they did not perform well. And I think that when you see the amount of money that was poured in to the investigations, to the number of lawyers that they brought on active duty to try these cases.
Millions of dollars.
Millions of dollars wasted. Wasted, because it seems like they went down the wrong road. And I've seen, people take General Mattis to task for that. And I've said this before. You can put a gun to his head, and you can tell him, you got to read this or I'm going to blow your brains out. And he'll look at you and say, pull the trigger. Right? He'll try to kill you before he says, pull the trigger. Hopefully you have his hands bound when you tell him this. He'll look at you and say, pull the trigger. I'm not doing it. That's him. He's not going to flinch. So to me, when you look at this, and again, I've heard from other people, that there was great discussion and great disagreement about the way this thing should be charged, and that they only had two courses of action. One was to get the guy who led the squad. Two was to try to get everybody on very small, much reduced charges based on their own statements. And those were essentially, because everything else was this conflicting bowl of spaghetti that was not likely to lead to a conviction by a jury. And as I've talked to you, I've talked to Neil, to me that makes sense to me. That at the end of the day, pushing all the other interventions aside, those were the two courses of action.
Well, of course, the initial narrative, and a lot of it was coming from the reactions with video cameras filming the body, and the original narrative that came out was that an IED goes off, it kills one of the Marines, and the Marines of the squad went on a rampage and indiscriminately killing everybody. So that's the initial accusation, the kind of narrative that was out there. So I think that was the starting point from which they were operating, and then they investigated to try to figure out if that was the case. We know that wasn't the case, but, they initially charged Woodridge and the others with shooting at the four locations, Roadside, House 1, House 2, and House 4. And just look at the Roadside shooting. They just gotten attacked. They herringboned their vehicles, and they're waiting for the follow-on attack, because that's what insurgents do. As soon as you get hit, and when you're trying to take care of your Marines and the wounded and the confusion, they hit you again. So they get out expecting this follow-on attack, and you got these guys in this white car who were not following the Marines' direction of put your hands up, don't move. Instead, they get out and they start running. It's easy to think these guys are the trigger men.
Right.
These guys are bad. Right. We don't know if there's an ID. And then they shoot these guys as they're running away. Now, can you come up with charges to charge people with murder for that shooting if you wanted to, based on the evidence? Sure you could. Right. Hey, these guys weren't a threat. They didn't have weapons. They're running away. Therefore, there's no justification to shoot them. But that's kind of taking it in a vacuum. And, you know, looking at the situation in the context of what happened, was, were Woodrich and Dela Cruz wrong in shooting at the guys at the white car? Yeah, they may have been. That may have been wrong. But just being wrong in a combat situation should not equate to you've committed a crime.
I agree with you.
If you, when you look at that decision to fire, even if it's a wrong decision, that doesn't make it a criminal event. And the same thing with the House 4 shooting. You know, initially charged them, and that's one of the ones that was, I think, the first one, first murder charges that they dropped. And they should have.
Why? So, why should they have dropped them in House 1?
Or House 4.
In House.
They should have dropped them in House 4 because the narrative that came from the Iraqi version.
Yeah, could you tell the, can you just give the basic facts? Because you and I are both familiar with it. We're saying House 4, and we know it, but other people are like, well, what is House 4? Can you explain what happened in House 4?
Sure. Well, after the initial, the roadside shooting and the clearing of House 1 and House 2 all happened instantaneously, about 30, 45 minutes later, Woodrich had set up an overwatch position on the road. This is before the rest of the fighting in Haditha had started. And on the other side of the road, they observed some Iraqis, they call turkey peeking. You know, they look around the corner of a building and pull back real quick when the Marines see them. And they observed this a few times. They thought, this is a little bit suspicious. So Woodrich took a couple of Marines, Salinas and Sherritt, and they proceed to House 4. And think of two houses with a wall around both of them. So they enter the wall, they see some women and an old man and a kid and say, hey, where are those men? And they point to the other house. So Woodrich and one of the Marines proceeds into House 4, cautious but not knowing what's there. They walk down the hall, they hear some sound from a room, step in with Sherritt first, and there is three Iraqis in there, one with an AK-47. So Sherritt begins firing until he says he's out. Then Woodrich steps in and fires and finishes them out. Okay?
Okay.
When they investigated all of these cases, and NCIS, and it was difficult to investigate in a combat zone anyway, but when they investigated, and they went back through all these houses that were shooting, House 1, 2, and 4, House 1 and 2 was more difficult to do because salacia payments had been paid to the families there and they had repaired their homes. So doing a forensic of a lot of things there was difficult.
Can you real quickly explain salacia payments?
Sure. Salacia payments is oftentimes when U.S. goes in there and we blow stuff up or kill somebody without admitting, you know, we were at fault. Sometimes we will pay money to compensate, for the property or loss of life, just as a matter of course, as a matter of policy, to show that we're there. You know, however, if they were clearly wrong, if they were clearly the enemy, well, we won't pay salacia payments. So this isn't an acknowledgement that the U.S. did wrong, but it's just a common thing that we do with, keeping relations with the locals, positive and things that we do to destroy things, trying to take responsibility for it. Now, the people in House 4 had not been given salacia payments. Someone had decided we're not going to pay them because we think whatever happened in there was clearly the work of the insurgents or whatever the decision was made. So when NCIS did go back into House 4, they could see the forensic evidence. When I say forensic evidence, I mean bullet holes in the walls. So when the accusation from the Iraqis came about House 4, what they were alleging is that these Marines pulled these three guys out and lined them up and executed them, shots to the back of the head. And if true, would certainly be a crime. Of course, we don't have the bodies, so no way, and you can't dig them up, so there's no way to corroborate that. So fortunately, in the case of House 4, NCIS was able to go in there, and the Marines' version of what I told you happened versus the insurgent version, the evidence there of the bullet holes in the wall backed up what the Marines had said. Now, why those guys were initially charged with murder in House 4 is sort of beyond me. But eventually those charges were dismissed, as they should have been. So everything dealing with Haditha should have all been about House 2. Yeah, you set aside the roadside that even if they were wrong, and I'm not necessarily sure they Woodridge was wrong in that shooting, even if they were wrong, no use in charging murder for that. Likewise, House 1. The platoon commander told them to clear the house. I believe firing was coming from that house. Even though they couldn't identify who actually was the shooter, there was firing coming in the house. They cleared that house. So, you know, armchair quarterback in this thing, this should not have been about roadside House 1 and House 4. This was all about House 2. And when you prosecute somebody for all of those things, it also gives the impression of, you know, these Marines are in continuous combat, high-stress situation. They're not SWAT teams. They're not special forces. And, you know, it's a confusing environment. They're under stress. There's adrenaline flowing. And to charge all four of those different things is almost an indictment of infantry guys on the ground, that almost no matter what you do, you can be charged for it. And I think that's what it says by charging all four of those different shootings as part of the case. When really what we should have been talking about was, just like in the movie, was just House 2, what actually happened in House 2. Yes. Although you can't look at that in a vacuum either, but
right.
That was certainly should have been the sole focus.
Is charging part of this strategy to coerce immunization to get statements and then ultimately immunize without those
absolutely
without that so we don't want that guy, but we're going to charge him. We need to charge him in order to get that. So I guess it's kind of, I guess, reminiscent of what some of the things we're seeing with the Mueller thing, right? You know, we want Manafort, but we don't really care about Manafort. We just want him to turn and give us information about the president. We don't give a shit about Cohen, you know. I mean, look, if we start looking for guys like Cohen in Washington, D.C., the Washington, D.C. jail will be filled with them. Because Michael Cohen did not invent himself. He's been in Washington, D.C. and New York City for decades. Guys like him doing that kind of work. That's interesting. Now I want to ask you one of the things that De La Cruz gets word to clear and works on the other side of the street, right? The other side of the main drag. That the IED goes off on. He and I want to say one or two other Marines, they don't kill anybody, and they bring 15 or so military age males. Talk to me about the concept of clear. Because clear doesn't mean kill civilians. Clear means, you know, you're going to clear. And if we do begin to encounter civilians, then ought to be communicated immediately. Hey, we got an issue in here. Hey, and that ought to be communicated widely, you know, that, hey, something's not what we think here. Talk to me about those differences and clear.
Well, clear. Yeah, you're right. That was an immediate issue in the case. I think the order was clear south. Is what Lieutenant Callop, what does clear mean?
Okay, hold on. Let me stop you there. And this is an important footnote. The majority of the guys in leadership positions in this platoon are novices. You have holdovers, lance corporals and stuff that are involved in the incident that were in Iraq in 2004. Primarily fighting with 3-1 in Fallujah, but the leaders this day are novices. Kalb's a novice. Woodard's obviously a novice. McConnell's on his first deployment to Iraq. Chassani's on his third. Right, he's done the march up. He's done Fallujah, and now he's back as a battalion, as a staff guy for 1-5, I think. And maybe the division, and now he's back in as the battalion commander. So, and I think that's an important part of this, because you want, if you think that this stuff's easy, you're dead wrong. It's not. All these things, and especially the you can come as an armchair quarterback and say, hey, the white vehicle, though, doesn't show up for 15 minutes. It's not like it went boom and these guys rolled up. Okay, well, maybe that's something you understand after you've been there for 90 days and you've done a bunch of fighting. Okay, and you could probably make that argument and be right. But when you're new and you've read and you've been told, hey, this is how this shit happens. Something will go boom and then something's coming to really whack you after that. Okay, I got it. Right? And the whole city hears the boom. It's that big. And now taxi gonna roll up, you know, on something that's smoking? Yeah, good one. Right? And then they're all males, they're gonna hop out of the vehicle. And they're not gonna do they're gonna be uncooperative. I'm buying that. And so to me that's imminently defensible. Especially when you don't have the requisite experience. So anyway, I just think that's an important point.
Absolutely. And you do start when you look at these cases, you say, what if? What if the Marines hadn't done that? You know, what if the Marines hadn't eliminated those guys? That could have been a vehicle-borne IED. They blow up and just kill more Marines. That could have been the follow-on attack.
Right.
And, I mean, the what ifs are amazing. And when you're dealing with somebody, like you said, who has not been in the combat zone, who's a novice there for the first time, and you've heard the training, you've got the intel briefs and what the warnings are and what the enemy training tactics and procedures are. And that's a lot to take in fractions of a second of what you're supposed to do.
Right. And let me tell you this. And then you're going to make a decision whether I shoot or don't shoot.
Okay.
And then what you've heard from guys who are holdovers, right, is, hey, when in doubt, shoot. Ask questions
right.
later. And let me tell you, and that's across the board, Iraq or Afghanistan, the advice you get. Do not hesitate when in doubt. Shoot. Otherwise, we're going to die. That's our experience here.
Ironically, is the one charge that Sansar and Woodard ends up being convicted of for a negligent dereliction of duty for saying that.
It's a statement of fact. It's got said millions of times over the course of combat in those two countries. Based on hard evidence.
Right.
Based on hard evidence of guys getting blown up, all kinds of guys getting shot, people who hesitate. Don't hesitate. And that's the difficult part of an insurgency. You know, it's a million shades of gray, and when it happens really quick, and we knew how good they were at it. And to me, that's the biggest difference between Afghanistan and Iraq. Afghanistan did not have the suicide bomber. And so when you went out, you had to be vigilant about IEDs. But when something happened, they didn't have somebody else who was going to walk up in your midst and blow you up. They didn't have a vehicle that was going to come up and explode like Iraq did, which caused a lot of killing of innocent people. And not just at Haditha. Okay? It happened a lot in our escalation of force issues that we had over there. You know, don't come close to the vehicle. Don't come close to the vehicle. You know, 2-1 just had 15 Marines just get killed 2 weeks ago. Don't come up. You know, all of a sudden this Mercedes is closing on your convoy and you shoot into the grill. It goes into a canal, right? And three kids drown. The mother and father get yanked out by the Marines. The interpreter, when you scream at him, tell him why the fuck he didn't stop. You know, nobody tells me what I should do in my country. Like, are you kidding me? And so, should you let him get next to your vehicle, knowing that he could blow people up and kill you? Or should you shoot and live with that? And that's a split-second decision. So.
Right.
Yeah. So to me, the white vehicle. But talk about clear, Colby. Your thoughts on the word clear, because it gets executed on the north side of the road different, I think, than it does on the south side of the road.
Well, I think there is a lack of understanding of what the word clear meant. When Lieutenant Callup tells Woodrich clear south, what exactly does that mean? And that was important because everyone was trying to assign what the word clear means during the case. So what Woodrich does is those Marines walk in there, they kick down the door of house one. They enter through the kitchen, they go into the hallway, and they stack along the walls. And what they hear is the sound of an AK-47 racking, which, as you know, Mac, has a very distinctive sound.
Absolutely.
And that's when they kick the door open, throw in the grenade, wait till it goes off, and then they step in and clear by fire. Another Marine enters another room, steps in, sees a military-age male man reaching into a cabinet, and he just shoots him without hesitation. And as they're moving through and clearing the house in that manner, that's when they see somebody sees somebody running from house one and yells, "Hey, we got a runner." And that's when they proceed out of house one and they go right to house two. So so the word clear is uncertain. So, you know, at that time, Marines, your average infantry Marine was not getting training on you walk into a building and distinguish one target from another.
Right.
In Woodard's mind, the threat was coming from there. They were receiving fire from that house. So they were going to eliminate that threat. Now, the ironic thing about this whole thing with House 1 is instead of clearing, as Calip ordered them to do, they could have called in artillery or an airstrike and blown that house up, and we wouldn't be here today. Now, could innocents have been killed in that? Absolutely. Of course, we would just call that collateral damage, and somehow morally that's different.
But they couldn't. They actually couldn't have done that. You're an arty guy. They couldn't have done that because they didn't have PID. They never had PID. They heard. They yelled, "Somebody shooting from over there," but nobody had positive identification. So they actually couldn't have dropped by our rules of engagement. They couldn't have dropped.
Yeah, but look, they may not have seen the shooter, but they knew how firing was coming from that house. Oh, and there's a difficulty in the application
right.
of the ROE.
Absolutely.
If you're receiving fire from one house, and you know the fire's coming from that one house, you can't see the shooter, are you just supposed to say, okay, well, we can't engage the house, because since we can't see the shooter, therefore he can keep shooting and we can't return fire? That seems like a ludicrous, you know, conclusion.
Well, I will tell you, as the ROE evolved, that's what it evolved to. Because if you cannot confirm what's in that house, you can't drop it, because we did it, and we killed a lot of civilians. And so, okay, so let me ask you this. So again, and clear is the enhanced Mojave Viper training definition that 3-1 went through, right? Augmented by whatever's left over from Fallujah, and what these guys have been told, and what lingers in their squads and their platoon and their company from guys who've already fought. So that's the definition of clear. It's executed differently on different sides of the street. Here's a question for you. As a defense guy, so as we go through and we're doing our thing, I'm a young American. All of a sudden, as the dust clears from the grenades and whatnot, all I see is civilians. I don't see a weapon, right? I don't see, we haven't been shot back at yet. Should I say something? Is that still, hey, it is what it is, we're clearing by the enhanced Mojave Viper, and I'm too much of a novice to even get to that point yet?
I don't think so. I think when they first walk into the house, knowing that they're getting fired from that house, and also, of course, the decision to clear was not Wooderich's.
Right.
The decision came from the Lieutenant Calip, who came up as part of the quick reaction force. Now, interesting enough, with just a kind of a side note, which was with all the Marines who were doing the clearing and then all the leadership who got charged with this, Lieutenant Calip was never charged. And he's the one who ordered Woodard to clear the houses. But
and he also drops a Willie Pete grenade on somebody in House 1?
Yes.
But he's never charged.
Well,
Allegedly.
Now, and don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating that Lieutenant Calip should have been charged. I just think it's a little hypocritical when you're going to go after the guys who did the clearing and not the guy who gave the order. So, but when they go into clear, so and you got to put yourself in the mindset of Staff Sergeant Woodard and these Marines. They're going into a house where they all absolutely believe the firing of them is coming from.
Right.
They go into that first room. There's not people in the house saying, well, you know, yelling anything or lying down and surrendering or having their arms raised, they see nothing. They go into the hallway, they see nothing, and all they hear is the sound of an AK-47 racking from a room. Now, could that be something else? Sure. Or could that be, as they rationally believed, that that's where the firing is coming from? So if they do that, then what do they do to clear that room? Do they kick the door open and have to find the one target?
Right. It's not so, how you do it.
As, you know, interesting point too is after the Haditha case had been going for a while, that's when we started that, started that training at Camp Pendleton for, regular infantry Marines to recognize different targets. So we had that, that training range set up where you enter a building and you try to distinguish between targets of, right. of who's right. bad, who's good. But that didn't happen until after Haditha. So what exactly are they supposed to do when they know that they're getting fired from that house? There's nobody in the room, in the house that they can see. They're holed up in a room and they hear the sound of an AK-47 racking. What action do they take? Right. And this is one of the, when it comes to house one, one of those dilemmas and why I think that you shouldn't charge house one. What do you expect a Marine to do? And we can argue all day long, but he should have done this, he should have done
they've seen nothing at this point to lead them to believe that there's either civilians there or anything else, right? They've been told to clear. They were told somebody yelled that they were taking fire from that house, right? And they go in there, and now they hear a weapon rack. And right. again, we're talking about the quick or the dead, right? The quick and the dead, and you've just seen a friend of yours split in two.
Right.
So I agree with you. I agree with
but,
you.
But yet they still charge that as murder going forward. And, you know, it was interesting when at the Article 32 hearings, they brought in a Marine lawyer, the one who gave the briefing to the 3-1 guys to testify, and saying that, providing basically an expert opinion that in accordance with the rules of engagement, this was a violation, which was interesting because what we then did was pulled out the actual training slides she used to brief them. And one of those training slides could have been, it looked like it was almost taken from Haditha. And the result of that question was, what if you, you know, receive fire, and you're not sure exactly where it's coming from? And the whole scenario in the training, almost mirrored what happened in house one.
Wow.
And what was more interesting than the question was the answer. And the answer, the multiple choice answers that the Marines were getting in training was, you can go ahead and fire, you cannot fire, or, you have to make the best decision given the information on the ground. And that was the answer.
You have to make the best decision. Good luck. Hope you don't fuck it up.
And a lot of the ROE training is like that. It's not clear.
Yeah, so you can understand it then. So when you then translate that to the world of the Lance Corporal, right?
Right.
What does it become? Fuck it, it's them or us, shoot first, and ask questions later.
Another way to look at that, too, is you got to make the best decision based on the information you have, so which is exactly what they did, and then they were charged with murder for it, which is just seems crazy. You're definitely in the realm of why it's difficult to charge a Marine with murder for killing who he believes is the enemy in the combat zone.
Right. Right. Okay, so that's house one, and we talked about house one and house four. Let's talk about house two. First of all, the movie is not out. I've had a number of people that have asked, hey, where can I see the movie House Two? And, it's not been released publicly yet. Are you familiar with it? Do you know when it will be released?
I do not know. I know it came out in the Tribeca Film Festival,
right.
To a lot of great reviews and awards coming out for it. Once it goes through there, I know Mike Epstein, the guy who wrote and produced it, has to find a home for it. So, and I don't know where he is on that, other than somebody's got to buy it from there. So either buy it to be released, buy it to remake it into a, you know, a movie. So I don't know where it is yet. So it's not due for release anytime imminently soon, but I imagine pretty soon it will be.
All right. Talk to us about Switch Gears and talk to us about House 2. And then if you don't mind, Colby, after we talk about House 2, I want to talk about Stetson Woodrich's trial and ultimately his plea deal. And then I want you to talk about the effect that this has had on American military justice, because I know you have some strong feelings about that. So
absolutely.
Talk to us about House 2.
Okay. Well, House 2, a little different conversation than all the other ones as far as what happened in there. And here is, as we talked about before, with Marines been giving immunity and giving their version, this is where we have so much conflicting information. I don't think we'll ever figure out what happened in House 2. The one thing
let me just tell you, that stuns people to hear that, and you're not the first person I've heard say that. That stuns people to hear somebody that was around this case as long as you were around it to say, I still don't know what went on, you know, in House 2.
Well, yeah, you're talking about a kinetic, chaotic situation, a lot of moving parts. There's firing going on in the house, there's clearing, and if you had tried to break this down in a situation where you got all the Marines in there and let's discuss, you know, what you saw, what happened there, and do this in a rational mode, it would still be difficult to sort out exactly what happened and who did what and who shot who. But in the military justice system, when they start giving immunity to people who are facing, you know, life in prison, people will start saying all kinds of things. So, there is a few interesting facts. Now, one of the guys that they passed on prosecuting was a guy named Chirrut, Lance Corporal Justin Chirrut.
Right.
And actually, in one of the statements he gave in the investigation, he actually admits to shooting during these clearing operations. Now, he wasn't with Woodrich when they went into clear House 1 and House 2. He caught up to them afterwards. So why that's so significant and why I was always puzzled by their decision not to go after Chirrut is the fact that is the pictures that we did have showed in one of the pictures a 9mm round on the ground, right? Now, why that's significant is neither Woodrich nor none of the other guys who went through and cleared House 1 and 2 had anything but M16s in force. Right, so it's all 5.56. So the only person in that whole group that carried a 9mm was Chirrut. Yet he was the first person that they passed on prosecuting, and that one's a decision that's incredibly puzzling.
And he doesn't. And again, the sequence of it is he's not in the initial clear. He somehow or other goes back in there later, and fires. Yes.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So again, it's really interesting when you read this and you're like, wait, how does that guy get a pass?
Well, and I think he got a pass because sure, it was one of those guys who kind of liked to exaggerate and brag about his conquest and that sort of thing. And he was one of those guys that we all called the gear queer. He always had extra crap on, you know, this cool knife and this little thing, right?
Right.
So oftentimes when Chirrut would talk, people would kind of just, okay, that's just Chirrut being Chirrut, and even a good kid, right?
Right.
So I think that's the narrative that was presented to the prosecutors, and they agreed and said, okay, yeah, you're right, and this must be an anomaly. But the problem is we have him actually acknowledging shooting in those houses and the picture showing what appeared to be a 9mm shell casing, which could only come from, if you're dealing with the Marines at Haditha and not somebody else coming in there that we don't know about, had to have to be Chirrut. So that was an interesting anomaly. Now, we don't know who fired, and really we're talking about House 2, that one room of House 2. So we don't know who fired in that room and killed all those people. And after the immunity, you have Mendoza blaming basically mainly Tatum. And after they gave Tatum immunity, Tatum is saying it was Woodridge. There was another Marine that was part of that group that was never charged, a guy named Corporal Salinas. And he was never charged. But, I mean, the stories were, and it's not uncommon that you're going to get different viewpoints from witnesses, and especially initially. It doesn't mean that they're lying. It means that what happens in, you know, chaotic environments is people remember things differently and different people strike them. So it's not uncommon to have, you know, four people say four completely different things of what happened, and they're not necessarily lying.
And that would be the case if they got interviewed 12, 24 hours after the events, right? They get interviewed about this how many months later?
Well, some of them it was fairly soon right after. That depends on who was investigating. But you also got to look at who's doing the investigation too, and who's doing the questioning. I mean, if you're thinking about, you want to really get to the truth of it, let's have a hot wash, and we're always going to sit down and let's talk about it.
Right, but that doesn't take place, right?
No.
At some later date, we're trying to put this together, and I'm just talking about the difficulties, you know, like, well, wait a minute. As I recall it, it's not like it's fresh in your mind that it just happened, right? We've done a bunch of other things. It's like, oh yeah, maybe that wasn't that day. That was this day. It's not easy.
And that's exactly right. Memory can be affected by a number of different things, to include your inability to perceive things accurately and fully at the time something's going on during your stressful environment. And when you're involved with trying to get to the truth of the matter, and NCIS is investigating, well, it's a whole lot different when NCIS says, "Hey, I just want to talk to what's going on." When they start off by saying, first, they have to read your rights. You're suspected of murder. That's going to color what somebody says. They're already thinking defensively. So, is that the best way to get to the truth? No. That's the system when you deal with criminal justice of what happens. That's why with cases like this, I mean, you can't assume that these guys are guilty, even if the narrative that comes out from, you know, the press or somewhere else is that they're guilty. You really got to dig down and look at exactly what they said, under what conditions were they said. You know, I've had cases where you supposedly have a confession from someone,
right,
and go in there and you get a not guilty in there, and you're like, well, how can you get a not guilty when somebody confessed? Well, because it's not that easy. Sometimes people are calling it a confession. Sometimes they're misled in an interview and told certain things, and they get them to confess. I mean, it can be a whole reason. And we've got this case after case of people who have been wrongfully convicted in this country when there's been a confession. So, which is kind of a whole different topic, but. So even if NCIS is getting to these guys instantly, you're depending on how those interviews are conducted, may depend on whether, you know, how trustworthy those statements are, whether they're colored by someone's own interest in protecting themselves or need to blame somebody else for some other motivation. So all kinds of bias starts entering into it. So what you got to look at is all the statements combined, all the facts combined, the forensics. You got to look at everything to try to make this determination, which is exactly what juries do in trials. So when members of a court martial look at things, that's what they're deciding.
Okay.
So and in House 2, it is I think a lot of people want to say, oh, this is what happened, I know what happened, and oh, this was clearly a crime, but it's not that easy, because there's a lot of conflicting information. And if you assign, you know, one person's statement or one piece of evidence has higher significance, then maybe it's easier in your mind to do it.
My experience was, if you do that, nobody reads right all the way through. Like, yeah, well, I assign his higher significance, but see everything from here down, it will all be contradicted by this statement. And,
yep.
And it seems
right.
Like you go through that throughout, and that's why, when it seems absurd to me that after all the money and all the investigations and all the time, that you would come on or multiple other people would tell me, I still don't know what happened that day.
Well, is there a possibility that this was a completely lawful shooting, even in House 2, and that none of these Marines committed a crime? I would tell you it is.
How? Explain the basis of that statement.
All right. So could there be a scenario where somebody else came in and there was a different threat that we don't even know about? So let's say that we don't know exactly the order of what everything happened because of all the conflicting statements and information. But let's say that Waters and his crew went through House 2, and that shooting was not even done at that point, and it was done afterwards. So what we don't know is the person, if that were to happen, what was that person perceiving and doing and feeling, and what threat was that person feeling when they took that action? So, It could be something similar to House 1. They hear something and believe, even if they're wrong, that there's a threat in that room. Now, do I think that's likely? No. But you simply can't exclude it. I mean, how about even the wild assumption of we see a 9mm round in there. And the results are in there. Could an insurgent gone in there and killed Iraqi people and make it look like the Americans did it? Again, I think that's highly unlikely given the facts of what we know, but can you absolutely exclude it? No. So, and the problem is it's so confusing that's in there. So now, don't get me wrong, Mac. I am not saying that I think that last scenario actually happened
right.
And that's what I believe.
Right.
But can you rule it out? And when you're dealing with a court of law, you're trying to find out what can you prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
So, I think the bottom line is we don't know, and we may never know exactly what happened in there.
Okay. Let me read.
I think what we do know, I think what we got to in the evidence was that Staff Sergeant Waters was not the one who fired in that room in House 2. That is the one thing that I'm certain of.
Well, and then, when you're saying, what's crazy about that is, and Neil said the same thing. Neil Puckett said the same thing. And he said, by the time we got to the final court martial of Sergeant Woodridge, he said, I knew there was no way that they, and he said, and I think they knew they didn't have the evidence to convict him. The question was,
that's right.
How would this play out in court? Because they were going to lose on that charge, and ultimately, what would we agree to? Because we all knew that he was guilty of negligent dereliction of duty. Okay. And we knew that ultimately he would plead guilty to that, but what else would there be? And they didn't have the evidence to convict it. So to me, I hear you say that, and what's booming in my head is Mendoza, telling Tatum there's civilians in that room.
There's women and kids in there. And Tatum responding, kill them anyway, or whatever the response was.
And they both got immunized. And you're like, wait a minute, what in the fuck happened? And then,
right before Tatum is going to trial, right before he's supposed to go to trial, they offer him a deal to say, do you have information against Woodridge? Yes. And here's what Woodridge did. And this is on the eve of his trial. Nobody, I guess they didn't stop to think of, well, wait a minute, this conflicts with our other key witness, Mendoza, that we've already immunized. And I guess they thought, we need Woodridge, so this is what we need to get Woodridge. What do you do then if you're a prosecutor? Do you try to not put on Mendoza as a witness, knowing that it absolutely conflicts? And what's that going to look like when the defense calls him to find out that he's been immunized and the government's left him off the witness list? Because they're trying to cover up the story that they created. I mean, you're in a no-win situation at that point.
You're in your own L-shaped ambush that you created for yourself. Congratulations.
That's exactly right.
Right. Let me read you an email, Mac. There's two of them here. First one, Mac. I've listened to every second of the interviews that you've done on Haditha. My question is, it appears to me that the prosecution team, whatever you want to call those guys, absolutely positively failed in the execution of their duties. And I believe that it makes a little more sense to me today, understanding all the pressure they had on them to bring these kind of charges because of the public outrage, the public statements made by leading elected officials in this country. However, I do agree with you in that at some point, somebody should have looked up and screamed, but I can't fucking prove that. And therefore, their inability to do that, whether that's a moral courage issue or not, or to me, just the salvation of my reputation as a Marine SJA, that's a failure. And ultimately, when you follow the crooked path of plea deals, immunizations, and what it got the Marine Corps, there's no way that you could look at the prosecutors in this case and call them anything but failures. I'd be curious to hear what Mr. Volke's thoughts are on that. The failure, that's tough.
That is tough. We're also attributing it all to the prosecutors. We don't know who made the decision on the immunization. We don't know if the prosecutor said, I don't think we should do this, and somebody said we should. We don't know if there's SJAs involved, the convening authorities making the decision. We don't know. At least I don't know. Somebody knows. So what I think is they had a revolving theory over who did what, and that changed. And the problem is once you start making certain decisions with immunities, you've been down a path that you may not be able to change. And I suspect that that's what happened here. And then the statement about somebody should have stood up and screamed, you know, we shouldn't be doing this.
No, I can't prove. I can't prove this.
I can't prove this. Well, let me tell you what, that happens every day right now when you deal with sexual assaults in the military. I mean, we are taking cases to trial that, look, every judge advocate knows. Every military lawyer knows has no business belonging in the courtroom. But because of the immense pressure that's out there dealing with sexual assaults, we're taking cases to trial that never would have made it to trial, that never would have made it past an Article 32. And that happens every single day. And so to put this all on the prosecutors, now, don't get me wrong, I think they made some serious mistakes and their choices and whatever they're recommending the committee.
Okay, hold on. Let me just describe the pressure that we're talking about relative to sexual assault is there's a move afoot, chiefly coming out, in my opinion, of the Senate Armed Service Committee that says we want a separate justice system for criminal assault. We want separate judges. We want separate people handling these things because you are incapable of handling this. All right, and so that's the pressure with the military saying no. It undermines the good order and discipline by undermining the commanding officer's authority. You need to give us an opportunity to handle this, and so we take cases to trial that don't have the evidence to convict, and then you see people getting bitched out like, well, this rate doesn't have a conviction rate to go with them, and you're going easy on them. No, if I'm an impartial jurist. And this evidence is brought to me, can I convict them? Answer,
right.
A lot of times, is no. I can't. So interesting. Go on, I interrupted you.
Although some people do get convicted, and you also look at, we keep changing the rules. And we keep changing the rules to try to ensure more convictions. We change the rules of evidence and the procedure, the actual UCMJ itself, and that's all been part of that pressure. Now, that happened after Haditha, but you're wondering why somebody would stand up and say something.
Right.
Well, you know, the prosecutor is not the one who makes the decision to prosecute or not, and does not have the discretion to dismiss something. I mean, there's all that kind of pressure that's out there. That's on sexual assault front, but there's pressures all over the place. So, and we don't know where all the pressure was coming from. Hell, for all we know, it could have been coming from the Commander-in-Chief, Secretary of Defense. And we don't know where all the pressure was on this one.
Right.
But what I do know is that I would say as a team, they certainly failed. Now, whether it's the prosecutors themselves or you combine that with SJAs or advisors or convening authorities, I would say yes, there was failure there.
Got it. All right, here's another question for you. Mac, I was looking through No Time for the Truth by Helms and Farage. Farage is one of Woodrich's military attorneys, yes, along with you.
Right. He was my senior defense counsel out there and co-counsel with me on Sessler and Woodrich.
Okay, this is his book last night and came across the following on page 268. Quote, Gravis, a stand-up Marine who avoided the incident at Haditha by moving north from Route Chestnut after the ambush, would get caught up in several webs spun during the unrelated murder trials of Kilo Marines that followed the luckless company like a black cloud for 4 years. Haditha was just the most famous. I am not aware of other incidents where Marines from 3-1 were charged with murder. Are you or your guest aware of other legal actions against K Company Marines besides Haditha? I'm not.
No, I am, and I would have known if there was any other murder or war crime type charges coming out of 3-1 from that time frame. I would have absolutely known it. There was not. That doesn't mean there weren't accusations or investigations, but there were no charges to come out.
All right, another email, and then I want to get to, I hope you're not in any hurry, because I still need you for a little while.
Sure.
Another question. Mac, one of the puzzling things to me, you alluded to it a little bit earlier, the battalion commander was, I believe, on his second or third deployment to Iraq. He was experienced. Those above him did not investigate either. In your interview with Puckett, you said there was never a time that you breathed the breath of air in either Iraq or Afghanistan that 15 civilians killed by gunshot wounds wasn't a big deal. I'm curious as to what your guest thinks was appropriate at the battalion, regimental, division, and MEF levels relative to this incident. He quotes me accurately, by the way.
Right, absolutely.
And I did. I did operations at the division level. I did operations at the regimental level. In fact, I was in the RCT-5 Combat Operations Center during the whole Hamdiya thing, and dealt with that. I was the one supervising the extraction of the remains and the movement to be loaded to go to Dover. When that body was pulled out of the ground. So I know, and I did the same thing, operations in Afghanistan. So I dealt with this shit on more than a dozen occasions. So, and I don't know why I quantified a dozen, but just to give it some, I've been there, done that kind of stuff. So your thoughts on the question?
Well, initially they had charged Lieutenant Colonel Shasani with failing to report at all, which is not true. He did report. It's a matter of what he reported in what context. And I think part of the problem with that wasn't the reporting. I think what really got this started was not the reporting of it. It was the interpretation that was given to the reporting that was then in turn reported back to the media. And I think that was the part that made everything look deceptive. So there was reporting by Chisani. He didn't keep that all to himself. Now, how you report it in the context of how you report it certainly can make a difference. So and you're also talking about if we look at just this one incident, let's say that's the only thing that happened that day, you would certainly have greater focus on it as well. But, I had great UAV footage of all the other fighting and battles that were going on in Haditha all day long. So, Colonel Vasani is looking at this after that entire day of fighting and trying to sort through, what was part of what and putting things into context. So I do think that if this was the only incident that happened, was the shooting with Woodrich's group on that day in Haditha, then I think it would have been a lot more clear answer. But there was, you know, there were battles going on across the city all day long. So I think in that context, he is looking at it in a little different light than, you know, just as we are right now, just looking at what happened with Woodard's crew. So, one, he did report. So it's not that he didn't report anything at all.
Okay, now, but he never physically goes down there, right?
Right. He sent Chad McConnell down there.
Okay, and so he doesn't go down there, and so okay, so he reports the regiment. Colonel Johnson, he's out further west, so he's not around. So this doesn't get investigated.
Well, I mean,
I tell you, for me, that's a bit of a head scratcher to this day. I don't. And what I learned from Phil Betts in 2004, working for General Mattis, was the SJA keeps your nose pointed in the right direction, and it also protects people, right? It protects the institution.
Yeah.
It protects people. And so, when in doubt, go out and take a look at it, right?
Yeah, I got a little more cynical view.
All right, go ahead. Hello? Uh-oh. Earth to Voki. All right, let me call him back. You're listening to retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Colby Voki. He was the senior defense counsel presiding over.
Hey.
What are you, pissed?
I don't know what happened. It just dropped off.
You started getting emotional, and your phone hung up on you.
I don't know what happened.
All right,
it's Apple. They're gonna hear what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. Big Brother's listening. Hey, piss off. So you said you have a more cynical view of it. Go ahead.
I have a more cynical view, which is we have more war crimes cases now than ever before, and I do not think that's because we have a more immoral or ill-prepared military. Matter of fact, I think we have the opposite.
Right, I agree.
But increase the number of lawyers in the combat. You know, you realize, of course, one of the things that was drastically different from OAS, OEF than ever before is we started sticking lawyers in at the battalion and regimental level, the same thing the Army did at the brigade level. So now we're sticking lawyers in at the fighting unit level. And what are these lawyers supposed to do? You get some company-grade captain, and it is we create an environment where somehow our commanders are not smart enough to figure out what targets we can engage and what we can engage. And I think we've created, this is a poor analogy, but almost like the old Soviet political officers that they used to put into.
Whoa! Don't go right? Soviet on me! What the hell?
And the purpose there was to make sure the units were going in accordance with, you know, what the Politburo was saying. Now,
right.
It's not that extreme with the judge advocates, and I'm not trying to say that it is, but you start including people in there who are naturally risk averse anyway, and we have to start, you know, commanders starting to ask them before they can engage certain targets and what should we do, and advising them saying, oh, you have to do this. So I think that's a huge reason why you're having more cases than you ever had before.
Yeah, but I agree. That's part of the reaction. But 15 civilians killed by gunshots, that breaks squelch.
Well, again, it was reported. So, again, they all say that it wasn't reported, but it was reported.
Right.
Now, what was reported and what was said and how it's approached after that, I don't know.
I do, Berkey. I know. That's why I'm going to make you smart right here. I know that you're going to be glad that you came on the program today. I did that shit, okay? I did it longer than anybody I know. And because I couldn't get promoted in the Marine Corps. And every time I went home, I never thought I was going back. And then I'd go back. And I'd go back and do the same shit. I'm one of the best, like, COC guys in the history of the Marine Corps because I did it so fucking much. And I will tell you, when I read the quote from one of the ops guys, and I think it was with 2nd Marine Division, when he was asked, so you saw that a minimum of 15 civilians had been killed, possibly as many as 24. That was, and he said, didn't strike me as unusual at all. That's bullshit. It's straight up bullshit. And I, so you're watching that, and it's like somebody's covering somebody's ass.
Well, what I would say is, in that vacuum of that question, I would probably agree with you. However, we don't know what else Shoshani was dealing with at the time, what other information he's received.
Right.
Shoshani's
just one guy in it, though, right? So, I mean, he bumps up to the regiment. They don't investigate. Division sees the same report, right?
Right.
And again, yeah, it was an ID, and yeah, it was a complex attack, but 15 civilians killed? Hey, boys, what happened out there? Right? Let's go take a look. Right? And again, nobody got to get charged, but that breaks squelch for me. And based on my experience, and to see quotes at the division level saying, yeah, there was no big deal. Bullshit, man. Bullshit. So anyway.
You might be right. And of course, I was never focused on.
Wait a minute. Did you just,
when I was doing that.
Did you just say might be to me? Volky, do you not
I
know
did.
Who you speak to?
I did.
All right, let me but ask. Okay, go ahead.
I will say this, though. You got an experienced battalion commander. You've got regimental commander and staff and division commanding general. And they all seem to make a very similar decision.
Right.
And there's got to be a reason for that. And what we don't know is the narrative of the reason for that. And I don't think that has ever really come out.
I agree with you.
Because of what happened with Dasani. So, I'm not trying to make excuses with General Dasani.
No.
That wasn't something I was focused on. All I'm saying is there may be other information out there that we just don't know.
Yeah, and again, my purpose in doing this is not to assign blame. It's to understand and hopefully to help people through understanding, right, know that this could happen to you. The next time we go someplace to do something, this could be you. And one, there's a few lessons learned that you got to get in your head, right, and we're going to talk about that here in a few minutes. But that's the purpose. This is already downrange. I don't think the Marine Corps has looked at it hard enough, and I don't think we've talked to people like you enough so that young officers can listen to guys like you and who've gone through what you've gone through and get the wisdom that you have to offer them so that when they come across it, right, and if nobody ever sat down with them and explained me lie to them or sansang to them, that they said, yeah, but I did listen to that Puckett dude on All Marine Radio, and I listened to that Volky, I can't remember what his name is. I did listen to that son of a bitch, and I know that this is what I should do. So that's the point of all this. Take me back to the Wooderich trial now. So going into that trial, are you confident at that point, given everybody who's been immunized, given the investigations done, the evidence that you have at your disposal, that Wooderich is not going to get convicted of murder?
Well, you never are. You're never so sure of that. And that's why you never tell your client, oh, yeah, I guarantee you're going to be found not guilty. Now, did I believe at that time that he was not guilty? Absolutely. But you also got to remember, too, at the actual time of trial, when trial had started, I had been removed from the case. It's a whole other story.
Yeah. Can you, in 2 minutes or less, explain that to everybody?
Sure. So, when I was representing Wooderich and was trying to stay on active duty to keep representing him before I retired, Headquarters Marine Corps says, no, you're gone. So both Faraj and I found ourselves.
Okay. Why did they say, because let me just be manpower monitor. Volky's applying for an extension. What's he need an extension for? Just another piece of shit lieutenant colonel. Like, we need one of those around. He's in charge of the defense, has been in charge of the Haditha case. He's a regional defense guy. and he's one of two active duty lawyers for Seth Sergeant Woodridge. Oh, yeah. Here, bring that over here. Signed, done. Yep. I'm not messing with that to get so we can get that downrange clean and tight and not going to impact the case. How did that not happen?
Well, that did happen several times.
Okay.
So it's funny. I actually got several retirement warrants because they extended me. And they give you little pins when you retire. I get a whole mess of those things.
Congratulations.
So, but at one point when it looked like, and this was due to the whole 60 Minutes interview that caused delays in the court-martial, Woodridge given an interview with 60 Minutes, and that became known. The prosecution wanted to get all the outtakes from CBS. They refused, and they came into the court-martial and fought it. The military judge agreed with CBS, and then the government appealed from there. That's what caused all these delays that caused Faraj and I to have to delay our retirement. And Faraj delayed it twice, but couldn't delay it anymore because of his circumstances. I kept going. My wife and family had already moved back to Texas for the retirement, so I was living in a trailer at Lake O'Neill on Camp Pendleton just waiting for the trial.
Nice. Quality. And people don't know, but quality living at Lake O'Neill at Camp Pendleton, in case you don't know. Oh, shit.
So I was basically, you know, sleeping there and living out of the office. And then when we found out that the case was going to the above the Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals and to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, that Whoa. Same issue, we knew it was going to be an even longer delay. So I called up and said I need another delay. And the colonel running manpower section up there, the retirement branch, said, no, you're gone. He thought I was homesteading. and I'm like, Colonel, I'm in a trailer. My family's gone, and I'm living on a trailer by the lake. I'm not homesteading. But so I was gone. I was gone after that. So I get back to Dallas, where we retired to. I start working in a firm. Now, the firm I started working with has a great lawyer, a retired reserve colonel named Dan Haygood. So what a great American. And one of the things that Dan Haygood had done when the Habeas case started was he represented Corporal Salinas. Now, Corporal Salinas was never charged, but Dan represented him. So now here I am, now continuing to represent Woodridge only as a civilian, but I'm working in a firm with a lawyer who also represents Corporal Salinas. It didn't appear to be a conflict at all at first, and we had interviewed Salinas and everything, and it didn't seem to be a conflict, but right before we get to trial, some information came out that may have suggested that there was a conflict. So because of that, the judge removed me from Woodridge's case right before trial.
Ugh. Wow.
So that's how I ended up getting off. Yeah.
All right. Give me your thoughts on where were you when the final verdict was when the final deal was cut?
I was in Dallas. I'd been on the phone with Faraj and keeping track every single day of what's going on. So I those guys had it. I felt a little bad and guilty that I was no longer on the case and there for Sessional Woodridge, but it was Hayden Faraj is an incredible trial lawyer, so. He had it. Him and Neil were taking care of it.
All right. Here's an email question, and I want to get to your thoughts on the plea deal, and was there any other recourse? But I want to read you this email first, Mac. I read Faraj's book a while ago, but it seems to me he believes in the book that there was some kind of conspiracy on the part of the government that this was all cast before it happened. If I'm remembering that incorrectly, please have Colby correct me, but I'd be curious about his comments about it. Is that true? Is that
no? I do not believe that. I do not believe the die was cast. And sometimes it could be easy to look back and say that. I don't think so at all. I think you had a lot of different issues out there. You had the large prosecution team. Sometimes you have like we saw with OJ, sometimes, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen. And I think they made decisions all along that were not the best decisions. Do I think this was cooked from the start? I mean, to believe that would mean that Gerald Mass was trying to set things up so these guys wouldn't have been found not guilty. I no way, no how. And do I think the prosecutor laid it out so that this would happen? No way, no how. I mean, sometimes these guys are doing some things that made us very angry. So there was a lot of fighting going on between the two sides, as there should be in cases like this. So now, by the time they offered the deal to Wooderich, it's a whole different narrative. It's a whole different story. I mean, those guys are, I think they probably realized that they were caught in a box that they can't get out of.
And again, when you say,
they're lucky to get the plea deal that they got.
Well, that's the thing. I was just going to say, and the box is not constructed of paper mache. Okay.
Right.
It's double reinforced, steel, right? That not going anywhere. That box that they were inside of. So I agree with you. They were lucky to get what they want. They get what you got. All right. So any final thoughts on the final trial of Stefan Wooderich?
Other than when they got into the trial, I think that's when everyone realized how bad it was. And I'm not sure that all the players realized. We're talking the SJAs and people behind the scenes and I don't think anybody knew exactly how it was going to play out until, trial happened. And I think that was the realization to everybody looking going that this is an untenable situation. Even had there been a conviction, the appeals would have been unbelievable. Almost certainly there would have been, case overturned and retried again.
Right.
So, there were so many issues in there. So there, you offer a plea like that, something to save face, and I can't talk about the decisions and discussions on accepting the plea with Wooderich other than to say, you're initially facing all these charges. Yes, they've been reduced down, but now you can get plead guilty to the lowest offense in military justice where you can't even get a bad discharge from it. And the most you can get is 3 months in the brig, and they're guaranteeing you that you won't do that. And offering these other protections, it's like, why wouldn't you take something like that?
No, it's a win.
So.
No, I'll tell you what.
It's a win. It's a first-class ass-whooping is what it is.
Say that again? It's a what?
It's not just a win. It's a first-class ass-whooping.
All right, you need to relax, okay? All right, Volky, you need to just relax. No, that's what it is, and that's what when my ops chief, I was the ops at 1 MHG. My ops chief, Master Sergeant Ernest Cardenas, was on the jury. So he doesn't come around. He'd swing by because it was going on not too far from MEF headquarters group, and so all of a sudden, one day, he walked back in. I said, what are you doing here? He goes, it's over. I said, what? What happened? I thought the defense was, because he had come around during the recess, right? There was a couple days off, right? It's not a recess, but there was a couple days off, I guess, when they were negotiating. And then they reconvened, and then he came back. And I said, what? And he says, yeah, they made a plea deal. I said, what was the deal? And he said, he pled guilty to one count of negligent dereliction duty. I said, what? He said, yeah. I said, okay, now that you can talk about it, sit down, motherfucker. And he's like, all right, sir, whatever you want to know. I said, how would you have voted? He goes, shit, sir, I don't know. It was all confusing. They came and they made statements. Then they all said they were lying when they made the statements, and they all contradict each other. Without hearing the rest of it, I don't know. I said, that's all you got? He said, shit, sir, it's so confusing. None of them, I don't think any of them told the truth, and I sure as hell don't know what the hell happened. I was like, damn. Damn.
Yeah, Mac, when I hear that, that's music to my ears. Because the government has to, it's not just a, what do you think happened? It's, they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's exactly what the top said is exactly right. They're now had to say that they lied about their earlier statement. They're all biased in a way. And how are you going to try to pin such serious crimes on Sasser and Wittich when all these guys are clearly lying? And they're testifying with immunity. And anybody who's testifying with immunity is suspect anyway.
Right.
So that what he told you is exactly what we anticipated would come out. And that's not surprising at all. And I think his reaction is right. I don't know. It's all confusing. I don't know what the hell happened.
Right.
But the next step is that is no way we can convict Wooderich of that when I can't even sort out what happened and all these guys are lying.
And describe the jury. The jury, if you saw a stack, have you ever seen stacks of ribbons? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you're getting experienced guys. And
yeah.
The rules are the default is all officer members, unless the accused chooses enlisted, then he gets up to one-third representation of at least one-third representation of enlisted members, and they all have to be senior in rank now. So it has to be at least gunny and above in officers. So, and for cases like this, you're typically going to get some people with experience. So that's what you're facing with a jury like this. With these members.
Yeah, they were serious combat veterans, those guys.
Yes.
So it's interesting. Let's talk about, and you alluded to this before, two more things to talk about before I let you go. One, impact on the military justice system of Haditha.
Tremendous. The impact of Haditha on the military justice system has been tremendous. I think there have been, I don't think it's even recognized, but I think there have been two things in the last, 20 years that have really changed military justice significantly. One is, as we mentioned a little bit, the sexual assault attack on the military and the changes from that. And the other has been Haditha. So prior to Haditha, we had war crimes cases coming up. And you got commanders deciding of whether this was a good shoot or not, if we should charge him, we should go after him, what should we do? Now, when Hamdani and Haditha came up, just a couple of months apart, Haditha was, of course, the one getting all the attention. I mean, we got local press, national press. We had Der Spiegel coming in, trying to doing stories on it, BBC Australia, you name it. It was such attention on it. And after they charged and the cases are progressing and we're starting to do the Article 32s, in the cases, we learn that there are leadership lessons from Haditha already being taught at the Air War College, the Army War College, Marine Command and Staff. So all these formal PMEs are already teaching classes on leadership lessons from Haditha. And to me, it seemed absolutely crazy and insane. How the hell are you teaching lessons? We don't even know what happened yet. I mean, hell, I'm the lawyer in the case and we're still trying to figure out what happened. So, lessons were learned and passed as these cases were going forward. And the result here is one of caution and sort of cover your ass. And this is where you get a lot of lawyers involved. Because you got to remember, in this case, the battalion commander, the company commander, the battalion judge advocate, and the battalion intel officer were all charged. And you got a judge advocate who was charged for what, failing to advise him to do certain legal actions and Chisani for trying to investigate, cover up, that kind of a stuff. And that was basically the gist of it against all four of those guys. So lessons are being learned about, are being taught at, across everywhere to include formal PME of what happens if you get one of these cases. And I think the lesson that comes out of this is, when in doubt, charge these guys and throw them under the bus and let military justice sort it out. And I think you had less instances of commanders making independent decisions about these kind of cases after Haditha was raised, which I think is a real shame.
I thought the lesson would be investigate it. You know, it's not necessary to charge it, but I think that lesson had already been learned. The investigated one had already been learned, you know, in the direct aftermath of it, whereas people had these discussions about how did they not investigate it. I think, to me, that was the lesson learned. You know, the fact that wasn't the lesson learned and charge them is the lesson learned, that to me is cowardly. Do the right thing.
And that's always, break that down.
And it's always been the standard. Do the right thing.
Let's break that down, though. Let's look at it and you say investigate it. Well, who's investigating? You got a command investigation or an NCIS investigation are entirely two different things.
No, it's command investigation, then we go from there.
So in this case, we had several investigations going at once. But command investigations, if you take that and you have a lawyer every step of the way advising of it, saying, look, if you investigate this and don't go forward on it and there's some question about it, they're going to fry you. You're going to get relieved. Hell, you may even get charged. Okay, well, let's go ahead and charge them, and maybe we let the court-martial.
That's our criteria now is how it impacts me, not what's right?
Well, but look at the lawyer advising the commander. Sir, you get a member. Just play this out. Sir, we have this one Marine who's accused of shooting this person. We have one Marine saying it was an innocent person, and it shouldn't be shot. We have another Marine saying, no, it was a legitimate shoot. So there's a debate here.
Okay.
Look, if you decide that that you're not going to charge this guy, then you're faced with that criticism because there is some evidence saying that this guy did wrong. So you're risking yourself and your command if you don't charge this Marine. And that's exactly what's been happening. Now, if it's an NCIS investigation, command investigations are usually to get to the truth of what happened,
right?
Now, sometimes they're also very biased when they start. So if the investigator has an outcome in mind, they can be very biased that way. So that's can be a downfall sometimes of command investigations, although most of them aren't that way. But NCIS, they're not out there trying to find the truth. They're building a criminal case. And I think this is a failure of commanders to realize exactly what NCIS is doing, because they're not out there. If they come across stuff that's exculpatory, it doesn't make its way into the NCIS investigation. So I did a case at 29 Palms with a lieutenant who was a CAT platoon commander in Fallujah. And he was charged with, they had detained somebody, and he was charged with murder for killing this guy. He engaged in hand-to-hand combat. And when you read the NCIS investigation, you had an Army PSYOPs guy that was attached to him who says the guy's hands were bound, there was no reason to do anything to him. A couple of the other Army witnesses that were there said the same thing. And when you look at this NCIS investigation, it looks terrible. And this guy, we're talking about a Marine Corps officer here who is being portrayed in this investigation. The only way you can read it is this guy is pure evil.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I met with the SGA up at 29 Ponds before the Article 32 investigation, and he says, hey, and he's a real reasonable guy going, Colby, I don't care what you do, but this guy's going to trial for murder. This guy's a murderer. And that's based on what you're reading in the NCIS investigation. I admit it looked ugly. By the time we got through with the Article 32 investigation, before that hearing was over, the case was the biggest joke of all time. You realize that the person who was saying things could not have seen what they saw. The other two were just saying what the Army Staff Sergeant had said. The one Marine who was saying things that were kind of mediocre had been pressured by NCIS and threatened to be deported if they didn't go along with the NCIS story. So by the time we got done, the case was dismissed, and everybody's saying, oh, that was nothing of a case. That was, the dumbest case, and we shouldn't even gone for it. But keep in mind, before then, the conversation I had with the SGA and reading that investigation. Now, the tough thing for commanders is they got to make these decisions based on the information presented to them. In a case like that, all they did is the NCIS investigation.
Well, let me
terrible.
I said this before you came on the show. We have a crisis in the American military at the general officer level. We have too many bobbleheads. right? The expansion of the ground war in Afghanistan should have never happened. How did it happen? Where were the Tony Zinnis and the Greg Newbolds that put their hand up and said, no? Where were the General Shinsekis that said, if you're to garrison, in the war plan estimate, to garrison the nation of Iraq is going to cost you between 200 and 300,000 soldiers and Marines? Yeah, you can go home. Don Rumsfeld. We don't have enough of the truth serum being injected. And what you're describing to me is I care more about my career, right, than doing the right thing. And if that's the kind of leaders that we have, then we're screwed. We're screwed. And I know it's you're faced with incredible, but if you can't look at it and say, here's the evidence I was presented. How do I take this guy to court-martial with this evidence? Right? Here's the cover letter detailing it. Here's my signature. What do you want to talk about? Is there new evidence? If we don't have that kind of moral courage, Colby, we're screwed.
I would agree. I mean, I look at the what we mentioned with the sexual assault. Look, we've taken all these steps and making all these changes. And if you talk to people not officially, they'll go, yeah, this is a bunch of crap. I don't like it. Yet that's what we're doing. And we're doing it just to satisfy a couple of senators. And they're also doing it to preserve military justice as they know it. They think if I do this, we'll retain control.
Yeah, but weren't you the one that told me that said if this went to a separate court system, there'd be fewer cases tried because a lot of them would not meet the threshold to go ahead and be charged in the first place.
That's right. So instead of defending the military justice system and saying we can always improve it, they've acquiesced in making changes. So you go back to the time of when the UCMJ was passed, right? We had something like 47 million men and women fought in World War II,
right?
There were 2.1 million courts martial coming out of World War II. After World War II, you had this mass exodus of service members now becoming civilians. And there were a lot of people pissed off about that. And you had a Congress that was made up of something like 79% veterans. and with all this people angry about these number of courts martials and the number of rights they had, that's the genesis behind the Military Justice Act and the UCMJ. And what you had was this tension, this conflict. You had members of Congress who wanted to stand up for the rights of the service member, so they have right to counsel and other certain basic rights. And you had the military and Pentagon on the other side not wanting to lose military justice and protecting their turf, and the ones that had the power of the convening authority. And the result of that tension was the UCMJ. And you can go back and read all the, like I've done, all the congressional discussions, the sessions dealing with discussion of the UCMJ. And the result compromise was the UCMJ. 1969, there were some more major changes to the UCMJ, a lot of them for the right to be accused. And since then, most of the changes have been the other way around. They've been fighting back the other way. And when this whole sexual assault revolution came to the military, and accused the military of sweeping things under the rug, which I guess everybody knew was not happening, instead of defending the ground and saying, here's our system and you're wrong and we'll address those problems and we'll do things to increase awareness of sexual assault and prevention, but we're not changing our system, they did not do that. And so when members of Congress were threatening bills that would take away military justice, they decided to start changing things. They changed procedure, they changed rules of evidence, they add this victim legal counsel business, which is absolutely insane. And major changes have been made, actually, to the statute itself. And so it's that kind of pressure. But the problem with the current tension is there's nobody there looking out for the rights of an accused. So you think, okay, well, that's sexual assault, that's limited. Not really, because the changes apply to almost across the board to all the cases. So if we have a Haditha again today, if you remember what came out in the Article 32, which was important evidence and witnesses being questioned, and I think everybody would argue in the search for justice that was an indispensable part of what was happening.
Right.
With today's rules, you would not get an Article 32 like that. Matter of fact, you might get an Article 32 without a single witness. because that's how they change the rules.
What's the point of that change? To get it to trial?
So it can't be questioned. So limit the information. Limit it to nothing but a probable cause hearing, so that cases won't be dismissed prior to going to trial.
Oh. Which takes it out the discretionary level, out of that level of military justice, and puts it in somebody else's hands.
Oh, and we've taken a lot of discretion out of commanders' hands on sexual assault anyway.
Right.
Ability to dismiss cases, grant clemency afterwards, mandatory minimum sentences of dishonorable discharges, things like that. So, and while those certainly affect sexual assault cases, all cases, so we have more of these war crimes cases going forward, all cases are affected by these rule changes, which are not good.
So,
and nobody is standing up for the rights of the individual service member. Nobody.
So how does
Congress is going the other way?
How does that normally the pendulum ultimately swings back? Do you see any signs of it swinging back?
No, I think the only signs of swinging back are not coming from policy or rule changes. It's coming from our military guys who are sitting on juries. And because no matter how much you change the rule, military juries are still smelling bullshit when there's bullshit there.
Right.
So, and that was part of the reason promulgating more changes, because they think making more changes that you were still having guys being found not guilty of some of these sexual assaults. Not all of them, but some of them. Well, it must be because we have to change the rules and make it easier to convict. When nobody wants to publicly say, hey, some of these cases don't belong in a courtroom in the first place. And we have taken away all discretion of commanders to be able to do that, especially for sexual assault. So
you're painting a moderately bleak outlook of military justice.
I absolutely am, and there are changes being implemented every single year at a rapid rate, like we've never seen before.
But again, to go back to what you said just a few minutes ago. The fail-safe in all of this right now is that ultimately a jury of Marines know bullshit when they hear it.
That's right. Of course, the only problem with that is, are they going to get all the evidence and the information that they need? Are they going to see all the right witnesses? Is the defense going to be able to put on the evidence that they need to be able to do it? That's where the rule changes can really come into play.
Does anything threaten that? Do those rule changes threaten that?
Yes, absolutely. Discovery of information, absolutely it does. So we have to be very careful about this because we can be going back towards pre-UCMJ days where these guys didn't have a right.
Right.
Didn't have many rights at all. And I think that would be a terrible thing. You know, there was talk of trying to change... you have the members find them guilty and try to make it so the judge does all the sentencing and would have to, like they do in a lot of other courts, in federal court. And why would they say that? Because they want some kind of consistency. And they were also have been talking of doing guidelines like the federal courts do. So the judge has to make a decision and then we tie the judge's hands on, what he can assess as a sentence. And I think that's a terrible thing in federal court as it is, and it'd be a terrible thing in military justice. And I think what we're saying by this is, look, we don't trust these officers and senior enlisted that we put on our juries to come up with the appropriate sentence. And I think that's wrong. We take that out of the hands of the members. It's like hitting on the jury system itself. And I can't think of you get a war crimes case like this, and you get members who decide it, and I can't think of a better person, a group of people in the world to decide a sentence than a group of members who have got combat experience, right?
Right.
I mean, and you look at the Hutchins case from Hamdaniya, and they found him guilty, and they found him guilty of unpremeditated murder, and they gave him the sentence. So they took into all those accounts of the situation and the frustrations and what he did wrong, and they came up with a sentence. And who's to say somebody has a better solution than that? And the solution they're trying to do is, well, we're going to legislate what the solution is. We're going to legislate what a sentence will be. We're going to take it out of the hands of the people who actually hear the evidence, and I think that's a terrible thing. Because I don't know about you, but when it comes to this stuff, the people that I, bottom line, trust more than anybody else are those Marines and soldiers and airmen who sit on those juries who have the experience and hear the evidence. Those are the people I trust to come up with the right decision more than any other.
Answer this in 60 seconds, and I've got one final question for you. It's kind of a current event question relative to something that the Secretary of Defense just did. What pushes back, institutionally, what pushes back? Is there an association of military trial lawyers that provides counsel oversight and whatnot? What pushes back against your concern in terms of encroachment on the ability of service members to defend themselves? Is there anything that pushes back institutionally?
Not a lot. We have the National Institute of Military Justice, who a lot of the smart people who often write papers and interject themselves, something I'm part of. We have a group called the United American Patriots, and that group, it's a nonprofit that I'm also part of that raises money for the defense of Marines charged with service members charged with crimes in combat. So they aid in the defense, and they've also been getting involved in trying to look at legislation and these rules themselves. So, but the audience that they often have isn't the greatest. So, and it's really tough to counter that. So when it comes to making these rule changes, very little. And it's political pressure, and that's what's driving everything.
All right. My guest for almost the last, well, for the last 3 hours, very generously, I've never done an interview this long in my life, for God's sakes. But it hasn't seemed like that long, and the discussion is very compelling and riveting. For anybody who would be interested in leadership, interested in Uniform Code of Military Justice, interested in Haditha, and all those, and all the events that surround all of those. So first of all, Colby, let me ask you one final question. Recently, the Secretary of Defense, wrote a letter, citing the need for better discipline in the armed forces and stop using admonishing commanders, essentially for using administrative tools when they should use disciplinary tools. Did you see that? And what are your thoughts relative to that?
So what we've been seeing happen, and especially happens with officers in the military, is they accuse them of something, but because they can't prove it, then they'll just go after them administratively and try to kick them out with bad discharges, take away retirements, and all that sort of thing. So, and it's a very frustrating thing if you're going through that and you've been accused of it, which is, look, if there's misconduct, it shouldn't be resolved at some kind of administrative separation or some board. That's not the place to resolve big misconduct issues, criminal issues. But that's what we do because since we can't prove it in court, we can take it in the admin realm where the person being accused doesn't have the right to compel witnesses to testify, doesn't have the right to discovery of evidence, and it's easier to railroad a guy and just go ahead and get him kicked out or deny his retirement or whatever the case may be. So I think that's exactly what General Mass is talking about. Look, if there's something wrong here, we need to be upfront and transparent, and if we need to prosecute him, we prosecute him. And if he's guilty, then we go forward. If he's not guilty, we go forward. And stop relying on these Mickey Mouse little administrative measures to resolve things that should be resolved through the military justice system.
Got it. All right, and the last question is the general question. Is there anything that I haven't asked you in the last 3 hours that you want people to know either about the case or about military justice or about the future? Anything that you think people should know that I haven't been able to yank out of you?
Well, we know... Everyone knows about Haditha and Hamdaniya is very public, and there's a few other cases, but there are a lot more of these cases than people realize. that I'm still doing them. I'm working on pardons for some of these guys who've been convicted. I'm working on getting people out of Leavenworth. I mentioned Derek Miller, getting him out of Leavenworth. And there are still cases that are coming up all the time that are pending trial. So these are not one-offs. This is a trend of things that is happening. And as we increase our involvement and combat presence anywhere, these cases are going to follow. So if we don't do anything to change it now, and object to it, this is going to continue on.
All right. I don't know if you ever get out to the West Coast. You should. You have a kid out here. If you ever get out here, shoot me a text. I'd love to sit down and over dinner with you and hang out a little bit. I cannot say thank you to you enough for doing this. I hope you don't mind in the future, now that I've got your cell number, if I bug you on occasion and bring you back on and let you kind of thump the Bible for UCMJ vigilance and reform and the issues that are important to you, or military issues in general. I hope you don't mind there, Colby.
Hey, Mac, anytime, bro. As a matter of fact, it wouldn't be bad. Maybe we sit down and have dinner. I'll bring my son with me. And he can hear this, because I got to tell you, it scares the hell out of me. Him being an infantry officer in this day and age with these things going on.
Well, no, and decentralized operations, you know, your people, it's not like a lot of times now that the company headquarters is near you. It ain't. You're out there, you know, if you're a lieutenant, you're out there alone and unafraid. And, yep. and they gotta be up to us. So give me the lesson, give me the lessons learned. Give me bullet lessons learned. These are the ones that I've developed. One, before you go, you have to know these things could happen on your watch. Alright? They're not theoretical events. Okay? And you've gotta know that this stuff can happen. When it happens, then what?
Well, I would say if anybody comes to talk to you about it and they read your rights, never, ever, ever give a statement. No matter if you've done something wrong or if you're absolutely innocent, you made all the right choices. Never give a statement. That's
never, because
one,
because you're never. And I'll tell you what, I'm guilty of this. What do you mean? I want to give a statement. I'm not guilty. I didn't do anything wrong. Yeah,
the more reason why you want to give a statement.
Of course, I'll give a statement.
I'm being truthful, and right. I'm telling the truth. And I haven't done anything wrong. Why should I not make a statement? And I will tell you in my experience, that's the absolute worst time to give a statement. Because not only can they twist those words, you don't know the context of the question they're asking. But even if it's a question like, "Did you do X?" and you say, "No, I did not do X," not only will they use that statement, they may charge you with making a false official statement for saying, "I did not do it." So that's lesson learned for somebody in that position. Know your ROE. You understand the battlefield. You got to listen to your people.
Okay, hold on. When you say know your ROE, all right, it doesn't mean do you have the sentences memorized? PID, blah, blah. No, it means you got to sit down and you've got to argue about them. You got to what if them. You got to war game them, and you got to know them. You got to know them like the back of your hand. The ROE is literally what you might live and die by, and you've got to have PhD level knowledge. However, you gain that. And obviously, if you're inexperienced, you can't have it by experience, but you can have it by bringing other people in to have discussions. You can have it by bringing SJAs in. And all that serves for is fodder for discussions in the application of those. Cause it's not going to be white, you know, white, black and white. It's not going to be whitey tidy. It's going to be variations of them. And you've got to say shoot or don't shoot. So that's
right. And you gotta understand those things, and a few slides from SJ and an RE brief is not enough.
It ain't
close. You've gotta think those things. And, you know, and we keep talking about ROE, and ROE is, as it's written, seems very simple, but it's the application of that is, which is very complicated.
And I'll give you an example. Just, Kobe, even in our discussion, when you said they could have very easily backed away and dropped the building, and none of this would have been an issue, right? My ROE training and I had a lot of good guys that made me smart about it. All of a sudden it's like click, 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 click. No. You don't have PID. You don't know what else is in that building. You can't drop that building. But based on the ROE as it was that day, you could have. But that's the kind of knowledge you need, and the way your brain has to work for you to survive in this environment.
Absolutely. You know, the other thing too is the application of the intelligence, the current information as it applies to ROE is a whole different area. So, for example, the ROE could be, you know, you gotta have PID and you have to see hostile action, hostile intent. But there was a time when dump trucks were a threatening force. That there was, the intel was that the insurgents were using dump trucks, they're loading them up with explosives. If you see a dump truck and he's coming at you and won't follow you, you can engage the dump truck. Now there's no weapon pointing at you, but what they're saying is that's what the enemy is using, and be on the lookout for them and be very careful about those things.
Yeah, now, and that wasn't bullshit intel either. That's the absolute truth. Here's another one. How about standing there watching a convoy on a cell phone? Is that a weapon?
Right.
That's right.
Absolutely. So the dump truck example, right? And the dump truck comes and say he's coming at a checkpoint. You try handed arm signals, pin flares, anything to get him to stop. And he doesn't stop, and he, you know, drives in, blows, you know, his intent is to blow it up and kill a bunch of Marines. So, question is, can you engage that truck if he, you know, you tried all those other methods to try to get him to stop, the hand and arm signals, the pin flare, can you engage the truck? Now, just think of the trial afterwards, right, and the use of the ROE against the Marine who pulls the trigger and shoots the dump truck driver, and they say, well, we didn't find any weapons or explosives in the truck. And with the truck driver pointing a weapon at you, how do you have positive identification that was the enemy? Sure, you had this intel about these trucks, but that's not written into the ROE anywhere. There's no mention of dump trucks in written ROE. And so you shoot that, and now they're using the ROE against you. Well, if you didn't have PID, you didn't have positive identification that was the enemy. And he wasn't shooting at you. He was just driving a truck. That's not hostile action. That's just driving a truck. So now you can see how these cases can go forward depending on what perspective you want to look at.
Right.
And
right.
I've seen the same thing. I've done cases that involve use of motorcycles in Afghanistan.
Right.
Where word was passed in an area and everybody knew, all the locals knew, do not drive motorcycle near the Marines or you're going to be... you know, viewed as the enemy. And as soon as a Marine shoots at a guy on a motorcycle, he's charged with attempted murder. And I know that for a fact because that was a case I had with Lieutenant Sean Blair out of Camp Lejeune. So real world stuff. And definitely the thing to remember is if they start an investigation and somebody ever reads you your rights, do not make a statement, ever. In Haditha, that was definitely true. The commanding general, when he was read his rights, didn't make a statement.
Wow.
So if it's good enough for the general, it's good enough for the lance corporal and the lieutenant.
All right. Give commanders some advice in terms of what breaks squelch, what merits investigation.
I think you have to take in information from everyone. You can't just listen to the lawyer and knowing that the lawyer is a risk-averse person, you have to hear it from everyone. You got to hear it from your subordinates. I mean, you've got to get the information from anyone. Just like you make any decision ever, it can't be just the lawyer you have advising you on what to do. And I think the good commanders make their own decisions. And look, we've had great commanders throughout the history of this country making decisions in wartime without lawyers around for over 200 years.
Right.
We, you know, fought in World War II, and just think of some of the Korea, some of the commanders, and some of the hellacious decisions they've had to make in certain decisions, and they've done it without having to say, "I got to check with a lawyer first."
Right.
So commanders got to make their own decisions, and I will leave you with one final comment, which was, even if that decision results in the loss of your career, when I was a second lieutenant at the basic school, we were doing a mess night, and I was escorting this one Marine colonel around. right? So I was the guy who had to escort the colonel. Right. And I'm young, and I just want to, you know, glean any kind of knowledge I can, and I asked him for any advice he had. And what he told me was that at some point in your career, you may have to make a decision and whether to do the right thing or the wrong thing. And you may have to make a decision where doing the right thing costs you your career. So the definition of courage is what you're going to do at that point. Are you going to make the wrong, make the right decision for the right reasons that cost you career or not? And he said, that's courage. And I would say that that's applicable now more than ever.
My guest has been Colby Vokey, retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel, Artillery Officer, SJA. Sir, thank you very much for coming on and sharing your knowledge and ultimately your wisdom with us relative to really events that shook the Marine Corps, shook the DOD, and I think ultimately the appropriate outcome with Staff Sergeant Woodridge was reached based on the evidence. But thank you. The ultimate goal of this is to make people smarter, not only about the events, but the lessons learned and how you should do it if it ever darkens your doorstep in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt. Keep up the show. It's great.
All right. Have a good day. Thank you, sir.
All righty.
There you have it.
Bye-bye.
I didn't think that would go that long, but that was awesome. That was awesome. You're not going to hear the Secretary of Defense's press conference. You know what? You could. No, I'll play it tomorrow. My thanks to Colby Vokey, one man show. He was the Regional Defense Council and was in charge of staffing all the defenses for both the Hamdiya and the Haditha incident. So my thanks to him for doing that. Absolutely, positively awesome stuff. This program repeats itself momentarily, so I would encourage you, don't touch that dial. What I'll do is I'll take that interview and I'll cut it up into some smaller chunks. And you can always listen to it. Just know what time you stopped listening to it and then pick it back up. But no, I don't think the Marine Corps has looked at that hard enough. I don't think officers have argued about it enough to be aware of some of the complex things that you can learn out of that. Tomorrow, Anthony Dries, United States Marine Corps, coming on the program. Amputee. We're going to talk about life with him. So, have a great day on a Wednesday. All Marine Radio is over and out.